author and music journalist Ben Westhoff, comedian and actor John Glazer, and Chicago musician Jess Godwin. And now, here's your host, a man who thought the fight for 15 was over Trump's cabinet, Justin Kaufman.
We don't want those 15! Don't give us those 15!
Oh, it's not about that. It's about getting paid a normal wage to work in the Manny's Deli at the Midway Airport.
Okay, gotcha.
Welcome to the download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on Michigan Avenue. Wow, we got a great show lined up for you tonight. I'm so excited. You know, it's fun because of the Blackhawks games and some Northwestern basketball, we get preempted a lot, so we don't get a chance. So we like to shove as much as we possibly can into the shows that we have. That is including tonight. Coming up after the 7:30 news, we're going to talk with Mike Fouché. He hasn't been here in a while. The DailyLine.net. We'll talk with him about what's happening in Springfield, also some news here in Chicago, but mainly about whether or not we can expect to see anything move with the budget stalemate. We've seen so much made of who's meeting with who. It seems to be the big storyline that's coming out of Springfield this week. Who's meeting with who and who's not? But we really aren't getting to the core issue here, and that's whether or not we are going to have a budget here in 2017, early 2017, when the money runs out. Mike Fouché will be in studio coming up at 8 o'clock. I'm very excited about this. The author of the book Original Gangstas, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap, Ben Westhoff. He will be in studio with us. He's going to be signing books at Quimby's. This book is huge. It's getting a lot of play, a lot of press, and Ben's in town right now, so he's going to come in studio and talk about it. I have spent, Pete, the last, 24 hours? When did we leave? I was here yesterday. We had the Blackhawks game, so we didn't have a show, but I got the book yesterday when we left here, 6 o'clock or whatever. That's when it came UPS, and I'm like, oh, okay, I got to read this thing. I have been reading this book. I've been reading about West Coast rap for like 24 hours straight. I mean, it's a big book. It's like 400 pages, and I am intent on finishing it. I have about 15 pages left. I'm going to read it during the news. But I am telling you, I am sucked into it. I didn't know. This is the untold story of some of the greatest rappers of our time, especially from the West Coast when you talk about Eazy-E and NWA. And obviously, there was Straight Outta Compton, the movie that came out last year, told a lot of that story. But the movie actually omitted a ton of it because there are some negative storylines surrounding these guys. They're not saints. They're not trailblazers. They're not pioneers. And they are when it comes to the music, but they also are very misogynistic. You can hear it in their lyrics. The amount of charges, like criminal charges, that they have accrued as a collective over their careers is astounding. You forget about, we know everything about what happens now in 2016 when it comes to the relationship with the police, but it was the West Coast rappers, specifically NWA, who really set off a firestorm by doing songs off of Straight Outta Compton that were specifically about the relationship and the breakdown with police. It's very interesting to think that was 1989, maybe? 1980, you think about it, it's almost been 30 years when Ice-T and NWA and some of the West Coast rappers were rapping about the relationship with the LAPD. And here we are in 2016. The more things change, the more things stay the same. So we'll talk with Ben Westhoff about this story, which is one that I want to talk to him about, is one that is, when it comes to music, why this was such an astounding story when it came to MTV and all the other people talking about the East Coast, West Coast feud and some great, great musicians being actually shot and killed because of miscommunication and beefs that played out in entertainment media. And it really is like a very, very important, but also historical moment in music. You just don't have it anywhere else. Like it played out in the 90s. So we'll talk with Ben, who put this book together. Also tonight, one of my comic idols, John Glazer. John Glazer is the star of Delocated. He's also got a new show called John Glazer Loves Gear. John Glazer was a writer for Conan O'Brien for years, and he also came from Chicago. He was a cast member at Second City in a show called Pinata Full of Bees next to Adam McKay, Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch. He's worked with so many people, lives in New York City now, and he's been done a ton of work with John Benjamin. John Benjamin, of course, from Bob's Burgers, and also a man who you can see in so many different things. His voice, Master of None. He was all those shows with Aziz Ansari. So John Glazer, Parks and Rec as well, is going to join us to talk about his new show and about his time here in Chicago. And also tonight, Jess Godwin's going to join us, singer-songwriter, who won the Three Arts Award. It's a very prestigious award that gives unrestricted money to artists in the Chicago area, women. $25,000 to do whatever she wants with it, and she's going to tell us what she's going to do with it. And based on her past projects and experiences, it's going to be something exciting. I'm glad to talk to her because she's got some great projects, including the anthology she's been working on where she has been taking conversations with her friends and turning them into sort of grandiose big songs and videos that she puts together and she puts on her website. So we will talk with Jess Godwin as well. And Character Flaws tonight. It's back. It's Wednesday night. We're back. Sketch, comedy, improvisation characters. Some of the best Chicago has to offer. Susan Messing, Rachel Mason, Robin Scott, Sandy Marshall. If all those guys will be here to do some bits. It's a great lineup. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll get the carry out. Stay with us. It's The Download here at 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, let's get the show on the road. We got a big one tonight. Very excited for all the segments we have up to 11 o'clock tonight. So let's start with the carry out. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. I guess we start in Springfield, where I think lawmakers are working this week. Not sure. This is when they work, right? Then they get like another 6 months off? Good. Just lost track of the legislative calendar. The big news is that the GOP leaders, including Governor Rauner, are hitting the media to bash. Rauner said that Madigan is not listening to the people of Illinois and is content with stopgap spending instead of a state budget. Then he made a new website called MadiganStinks.net and funded a documentary about the history of Madigan's eyebrows. But maybe the bum rush worked because Madigan did show up this afternoon to a leaders meeting. And the takeaway? Well, Madigan doesn't want to change the status quo. Hey, listen, I'm all about bashing the status quo, and even Speaker Madigan. But he has said since the get-go that the turnaround agenda items like workers' comp and turn limits, they should be negotiated outside the lines of a state budget. And both Rauner and Madigan continue to hold the state budget hostage until they get their way. I know that it's maybe embarrassing or maybe it's viewed as politically weak, but I don't know. Why don't we do that? Why don't we get a state budget that's balanced and includes lean spending and realistic revenues and then work on the four turnaround agendas next? Oh, wait, that's right, because nobody trusts each other. Rauner and Madigan are becoming like the characters in Spy vs. Spy, the cartoon. Yep, they're becoming cartoon characters. So now Madigan wants the House to vote on a Rauner tax increase, saying that the governor wants to raise taxes to balance the budget, which the governor says, what? So maybe not Spy vs. Spy, maybe Starbelly Sneetches? Or maybe this is more Roadrunner Coyote, Tom and Jerry? These guys are the 2016 version of the Smothers Brothers, which is hilarious if it was comedy. But it's the future of our state. So, I don't know. Maybe raise the two-drink minimum to three? Moving on, President-elect Donald Trump was rumored to be coming to Chicago tomorrow for a long weekend. Maybe take in an architectural tour, see if he can get into the Purple Pig. Maybe stroll Michigan Avenue, get a Star Wars toy at the Disney store for young Baron. But no, the trib has been told that the trip is off. Darn it. I wanted to see him jump out of his helicopter and rappel down his building. Yeah, guess next time. Trump just nominated Todd Ricketts of the famed Ricketts family for Deputy Commerce Secretary because, well, Todd Ricketts gave him a ton of money during the campaign. You know, pay-to-play politics, as it's been done in Washington for years, but voters want to see it changed. Right. I wonder if Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs, is like, darn, I wish I was Deputy Commerce Secretary. I'm not going to own this stupid World Series baseball team. I hate my dad. In weather, I guess it's going to snow. You ready? I'm ready. It's like right around the corner. And it's not going to stop till May. We ready? Good. Also, winter parking ban in effect starting tonight, so I hope we don't all collectively get towed. Something tells me that's going to happen. In sports, it's time for the Braverman.
Wide receiver Daniel Braverman was activated from the practice squad, and the newspapers are going crazy. What? His seventh rounder? Okay, great. Oh, I see. It's a Tom Waddle thing. The Bears officially activated corner Kyle Fuller. Fuller was out since preseason with a knee injury. But what it really means is that wide receiver Kevin White is done for the year. I guess you can only bring one guy back from the IR for whatever reason that has nothing to do with football. Cutler's still out, and so is pretty much the entire team. I wouldn't be surprised if John Fox ends up missing the game on Sunday with a cough, because why would you want to go to work if this was your job? Also, rumors that the tickets for Sunday's game against the Niners are pretty much going for peanuts, literally. Peanuts and maybe a Starbucks gift card. I'm guessing the total will be, the attendance will be like 800 people. I mean, who would want to come watch the worst two teams in football play in terrible weather? Not me. In baseball news, the Cubs signed free agent John Jay, which means that Dexter Fowler's not coming back. Free range is looking for a multi-year deal worth millions, and he's going to get it, just hopefully not in St. Louis. On the South side, what's up with the rumors swirling that the Sox are ready for a fire sale? The Sox have been quiet, but all those pesky baseball writers are hearing whispers that they are willing to deal Chris Sale for a ton of blue chip prospects. Cubs style. Except I read that the Sox won't deal with the Cubs. Yep, it's like some sort of management thing. So don't expect Sale on the north side, although that would be pretty boss, right? Sale to the Cubs and all those Cubs minor leaguers that can't find a spot could start right away on the Sox. As a matter of fact, let's go one step further. Couldn't the Sox just move their designation to AAA so we can see all this minor league talent by just taking the red line? Huh? I think it works. Works for everybody. In basketball, the Lakers are in town tonight. Take on the Bulls. Used to be a marquee matchup back when Shaq and Kobe would come through, but not that big of a draw now. Maybe in 2 or 3 years. The big draw will be Friday when LeBron comes to the UC, and he lost his bet, so he'll have to wear a full Cubs jersey to warm-ups. I guess that's better than a shirt with a political statement. Oh, he'll have that on underneath? Cool. Very cool. The Blackhawks won in a shootout last night, but third game without Jonathan Toews, who's out with an upper body injury, which could be a shoulder injury, a concussion, or pectoral bruise, or just a bad hair day. I mean, it's an upper body injury. Who knows? And finally tonight, the man who invented the Big Mac died today at the age of 98. He was credited with bringing the burger to the McDonald's menu back in the mid-60s. His last words, "The secret sauce is moldy ketchup." That's the carryout for November 30th, 2016. Hey, it's the final hours of the final day of November, so you still have some time to make it the best month ever. Go do it. Go. Now.
All right, coming up, we'll get the latest on Springfield. Also talk about some news here in City Council. Mike Fouché is in studio. We'll do that. It's the news, yeah. Also coming up, we'll talk with Ben Westhoff about his book, Original Gangsters. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm good. I'm down to the last two pages of this book.
Which one?
This book I'm reading called Original Gangsters.
Yeah.
I'm at the point where, and it's really interesting because we're going to talk about that the East Coast, West Coast rap feud that Tupac and Biggie both died in, it was sort of solved by Minister Farrakhan in the Nation of Islam. He called everybody to Chicago and they had this big summit and it's sort of closed doors or not a big thing. And after that, it was over. So we'll talk about what went down in that summit that made that work. So
Farrakhan still has a bit of clout.
Yeah, right?
A little bit. A lot of bit.
All right. Busy day in politics, I guess, as the guys and gals down in Springfield get back together in a lame duck session here. I don't even know how much time is left in this session, but
one
Mike
day.
Fouché knows.
One day. Tomorrow is the last day.
And then we don't see any sort of legislative work until, what, January?
Well, they'll swear in all the new people and then January.
So it is kind of prime time. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us on Wednesdays here on the download to talk about all things Illinois politics. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about this because we've seen a lot of rhetoric today. Governor Rauner was on this station, 720 WGN, this morning talking about how Madigan was not showing up to meetings. He doesn't want to negotiate. We saw Leader Durkin come out and say Madigan doesn't want to have a budget. There's this Republican rhetoric that Madigan is bad for the state, but not only that, that he doesn't want to change the status quo, and the status quo has gotten into this trouble.
So let's talk about what's real and what's not real, okay? What's real is that the state needs to pass a budget, a stopgap budget, tomorrow if it's going to avoid some sort of shutdown. And there needs to be more money, some cash, in order to keep the budget going. There is no annual budget. There hasn't been for 2 years, so they need to do something temporary. And they need to come up with some cash, which is potentially a tax increase. And what is also real is that Rauner has said, I'm not going to pass any kind of tax increase unless, and he had four things this morning, and then this afternoon it became two things.
And they're the old turnaround agenda items.
Right, and right. So the two things are, he wants to have term limits for legislators, and he wants to have a permanent tax freeze, or property tax freeze. So, you know, the problem with the term limits is legislators don't like that. Madigan doesn't like that. He's been there for 30-something years. And the problem with property tax freeze is that there are a lot of municipalities, Chicago included, that rely on the ability to be able to raise their property taxes. In fact,
as we just saw,
all of southern Cook County is about to run into a major crisis, all of these towns, because their property taxes have maxed out and they need to keep raising them in order to just stay solvent. So, you know, this is like a real serious issue that's coming along. What's not real is this whole idea that Rauner says, well, Madigan has not been coming to the meetings. You know, Madigan has been a pain in the butt when it comes time for these set meetings. But it's a set piece where you have Madigan and you have Democratic Senate President Cullerton, and then you have the two Republican leaders,
Rodonio and Durkin.
And then Rauner as well. But the truth is that Rauner really owns Durkin and Rodonio. I mean, he basically paid for all their campaigns. They'll do anything that he says. So he doesn't need the Republican leaders there. And Cullerton, although he's not a eunuch, he certainly he's going to go along with a lot of what Madigan says. And, you know, Bruce Rauner could pick up the phone and call Mike Madigan and say, hey, what's up? You want to talk? I mean, that could happen at any time. And they could cut a deal at any time. So the idea that there has to be a set piece.
Well, let me ask, because
kind of ridiculous.
The Speaker Madigan has said all along, and he hasn't really changed his position, neither has Governor Rauner. They both have been steadfast in this idea that to pass a balanced budget for the state of Illinois, it needs to include these turnaround agenda items that the Republican governor wanted to have in the budget.
Right.
Speaker Madigan has always said, Those are policy driven. Those are outside the budget. Let's balance the budget, and then we'll talk about that
right,
next.
Right.
And that's what we've been fighting about for 2 years.
Right.
We've been talking about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And here we are at the final moment again, final minute again. And those you're seeing Governor Rauner's turnaround agenda items get peeled back.
Coming back.
Down to two.
But
I mean, isn't there something to be said that, you know, without the votes, and there are no votes for Republicans in either the House or the Senate, there really isn't much maneuver except for the idea of not passing a budget for the governor.
Right. Well, so if there's no budget and government shuts down, pretty much Rauner's going to get blamed for it. He's the governor. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You know, you folks at home that are listening to me talk right now, you actually think a lot more about politics than most people do. And so the fact is that most people in Illinois, when they hear the government was shut down, they're going to say, ah, the governor, he did it. So that is on Madigan's side. And there's a lot of people who think that Rauner all along was expecting to push some sort of last minute lame duck tax increase right now. And the reason it's called lame duck is that there's a bunch of people who are still serving that haven't left office yet and aren't really beholden to anybody. So they could vote for whatever they want. And so Rauner would be able to get that tax increase passed during the lame duck session. And then he would be able to then say, ah, those horrible Democrats that we beat, you know, they voted for it anyway. You can't trust a real Democrat. Us Republicans are squeaky clean.
So that's what's happening when you hear Speaker Madigan say, well, let's get this lame duck tax increase on the roll.
Yeah, let's rock and roll.
He wants the House to vote on it tomorrow to see where everybody stands, because he knows that that's going to be political fodder for January when everyone starts.
So he's basically put the governor into a trick box, and, you know, which is kind of fun. So the governor is in this spot where, well, if they're going to have the tax increase. Madigan's saying, hey, you know what? It's your tax increase too, Governor. And if it doesn't shut, if the government shuts down, well, it's Governor Rauner's fault.
And he keeps calling it. It's politics. I mean, you hear Governor Rauner and Republican leaders saying Madigan won't cooperate. You hear Madigan saying it's Rauner's tax increase.
I mean,
they really are starting to pull out all the rhetoric at the last moment.
Yeah. And you know, it's probably where it stands right now. It's probably going to work. I mean, Rauner could come up with something else at the last minute and do some little jujitsu, but that's kind of where we're at.
So as we go into the last day, and tomorrow's a day that you'd want to pay attention to when it comes to state government, because we'll see if a budget actually gets passed. And if it doesn't, that means that the money's going to run out before the new session starts in January.
Yeah.
So we will be in a position where there will be there's going to be a lot of shutdown government emergency situation before we even get back into it.
Maybe there will be a shutdown. Maybe there won't. You know, one of the things that Rauner has been really good at is figuring out ways to have certain bills paid and not paid. And actually, the number one ally that he's had for that has been Comptroller Leslie Munger, who was just defeated in this special election by Susana Mendoza,
yeah,
who the city clerk, who will be sworn in on Monday. So as comptroller, she could completely change. The comptroller has a lot of power in this situation where they decide which bills get paid first.
Right.
And she could totally change it. She could jam up the work. She could make it a lot worse so that there would be a shutdown
sooner. And just looking at it, and from your perch at Daily Line, do you feel like there's going to be some sort of spending plan or balanced budget that'll be done by tomorrow?
I have no idea. I really don't.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's fade to black. You know, I mean, I have no idea.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday here. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, talk about some stuff happening with the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
Some big, substantial
Mendoza's
stuff.
Leaving.
And Mendoza's leaving. Who's going to replace her? Mike here on the download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Mike Fouché from the Daily Line. We're talking about today's big day in politics and government. Tomorrow, we will have the end of the lame duck session in Springfield. Will we have a budget, a balanced budget, a spending plan, anything?
Who knows?
Join us tomorrow. We need a whole crew in here to be like, dun, dun, dun.
I kind of like the idea of like the adventure things, you know, kind of
right,
like the Indiana Jones kind of idea.
Right. Tune in tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, well, and Mike Madigan with like a whip.
One story today that was pretty buried in the headlines, but has a lot of implication is the idea of finding money for transit projects here in Chicago.
Right.
Talk about this.
So Chicago desperately needs to upgrade the Red Line, especially on the north side. And they also want to extend the Red Line all the way down to the limits of the south side of the city. And so they need to come up with some money for it. There's already money set aside in the federal government.
We just talked about this with Mary Sue Barrett, the idea that the federal government has all this money that Dick Durbin has secured for the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago for transportation projects, because it was about the new Trump elect.
Yeah.
And if I have this right, because we don't have a state budget, which essentially would give matching funds, it's a matching fund grant, there's no way to get it. But the city has found a workaround.
So typically these huge projects are done like 50% or 60% federal, 30% state, and then 10% city. But the state hasn't had a capital transportation spending budget in over 2 years since, or more than that. And so they're not able to come up with the money for this. And so the brilliant idea was creating this new kind of tax increment financing, a TIF district, that would surround all of the L district, all the L lines in the city. And so you'd be able to extend a distance and then scoop up money from all those areas. And so it's going to be about, I think, $21 billion or $2.1 billion. I can't
but
remember.
Essentially, the concept
and it's
is
gonna
to
be
get that
over,
federal money, right?
It's going to be over a long period,
all right,
you know, 32-year period, and they're going to scoop up this money, and then they're going to use it. And so what they do is that they avoid having the state
now,
pay anything.
I got to ask, because I think this is maybe this is the conspiracy theorist in me, but I mean, doesn't that set an awful precedent that once again we're avoiding this? That kind of happened with the Safe Roads Amendment too, where all transportation costs that come from stickers and roads and tolls now go into transportation projects, so we don't have to deal with the state of Illinois and their budget problems. Are we gonna? Is this how we're going? We're never gonna see a budget.
You know, funny thing is that this is basically exactly what Bruce Rauner wants, which is the state pays for less and less of Chicago's projects. So I mean,
so in a way, this budget stranglehold has been happening in
is totally working for Bruce.
It's working in the way that you're seeing less in less resources that are needed to run the state government.
Bruce Rauner, long before he ran, there's a famous speech that he gave where he said, in order to take control of the state, what you need to do is put a stranglehold on all the social programs that the Democrats hold dear. And by putting a stranglehold on them, by cutting them off, Democrats will eventually do what it is that he wants in order to reform the
privatize.
State. Privatize, change workers' comp, all these other things. And that is what he's been doing by not passing a budget. By not having any kind of budget, he continues to have a stranglehold on social programs. And you could also argue that big transportation programs in the city are part of what it is that
you're right. I mean,
Bruce Rauner says Democrats really love.
Now, I mean, at least in two different scenarios now, you've seen projects that needed state money to get federal matching grants
yes.
done by the city.
Yes.
So we're paying for that. We're
yes.
paying for that through TIFs if you live in the city.
Yes.
And then the same with the Safe Roads Amendment in the way that you don't have to sort of earmark it in a budget
yes.
anymore. It just goes straight from. So he
yes.
has found, I mean, in a way, he through these sort of projects, he's found a way to get at his sort of philosophical core.
His plan was always, if you take this speech that he gave a couple years before he ran for governor, to restrict as much state spending as possible to big spending programs that, he, in his words, Democrats
now,
love.
It's really interesting to me because maybe the media doesn't pick up on that as much. Maybe the people at home don't pick up on that. But you know who picks up on that? Mike Madigan.
Yeah,
in the way
absolutely.
That so when absolutely. We have these sort of
and you know, state legislators
and the state legislators, they understand what's happening. So when
right.
you have this media blitz, when so many people talking about, you know, oh, badmadigan.com or whatever it is,
right.
there is this sort of undercurrent that this stranglehold may be intentional
yeah.
in the way that they want to change the way government works.
Everybody in social services, anybody you talk to, anybody that's running a social service program or an agency, you know, the big from Catholic Charities all the way on down to the smallest organizations, mm-hmm. they will all tell you this, that this is essentially a plan on behalf of Bruce Rauner, because in the past, these people would be able to go to the governor's office, Democrat or Republican, and say, hey, can you help us out with
this? And they
this?
Would be able to help. Right?
And they would be able to help.
Or
but
at least
it's
yeah,
pretty much been
support.
A talk to the hand kind of scenario.
The other issue, as you mentioned, Susana Mendoza won for comptroller. She will be sworn in on Monday.
Right,
that's
city clerk.
That's going to yeah. be big. So city clerk is open. Rahm Emanuel will appoint that position. Do
right.
we have any inkling of what he thinks to be doing with the city clerk?
So, I mean, this is kind of crazy. So, you know, we know here's the rule. The one law that we know is that according to the statute that was passed for the special election of comptroller, the comptroller has to be sworn in on December 5th. There is nothing on the books for the state law about the city of Chicago or any of Chicago's ordinances about how exactly and when a clerk
Someone
should be,
needs
appointed.
To be
appointed. The mayor appoints it, but there's nothing that says when it has to happen. So,
but you would think there'd need to be some speed to this.
Probably, because there's certain official duties that a clerk has to do. But, you know, maybe it could be a deputy clerk for a while. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the mayor has some wiggle room, probably, in terms of when he appoints it. There's a lot of thinking, oh, maybe it has to be by Monday, but not necessarily.
Taking a page from corporate America where they're like, let's just keep it open and
right.
see
no,
if anyone
exactly.
rises to the
right.
top and then
exactly.
not fill the position. Right?
So, you know, the mayor early on said, hey, it's going to be somebody who's a Latino. And he hinted that it would be a Latino. And immediately every member of the City Council Latino Caucus said, oh, what about me?
I'll do it.
Right,
sure.
I'll do it. And so then like four or five of them took their names out. But then what started to happen is through our reporting and through the Sun Times and other folks is that a group of women have cropped up as names. And so one of them is Ana Valencia, who is a young woman in her early 30s who is the mayor's director of intergovernmental affairs. Mm-hmm. She's not from Chicago. She's originally from the Peru Valley in central Illinois. The other is Maria La Plesic, who is the director of consumer affairs,
okay.
You know, big cabinet agency for the mayor.
She has experience.
And then the other is Clarisol Duque. And Clarisol Duque is the chief of staff for Governor Dick Durbin. Clarisol's husband.
Senator Dick Durbin.
I'm sorry, Senator Dick Durbin.
You're getting ahead of yourself.
Sorry. Did I? Okay. And Clarisol's husband, Omar Duque, is the chair of the Illinois Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. So they're both from Chicago. They've got a lot of juice
in this. It's worth looking at. Mike Fouché, always a pleasure to talk to you, man. It's been
too
long.
Great to be here.
Good to talk
to you. Miss
Mike
you
Fouché.
In your gray sweater.
I know. It's that time of year, man.
I know.
Bring the gray
sweater
out.
I got to wear a microwave sweater.
That's right. I knew it was Wednesday. Yeah. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line, thedailyline.net, joins us Wednesdays here on The Download. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Ben Westhoff about his book, Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the birth of West Coast rap, and how it all sort of the big West Coast to East Coast feud really ended. It was settled here in Chicago. We'll talk about that coming up here after the news. California. So interesting. This song is a song that I've always disliked. It's one of those that I'm like, it was at the height of just the sort of wrought, sort of over-sensationalized Tupac, you know, everything in there. But after reading your book, Ben, I'm like, I want to go back in to all this music again. I mean, it really is something intense, if that's the right word.
Yes, it was all intense, wall-to-wall.
Last year, the movie Straight Outta Compton told the story of the controversial rap group N.W.A. The movie was very successful, garnering nominations during award season, but there was some controversy around the movie. It was produced by Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, so a lot of the plot skimmed over some of the more negative aspects of the band's story, including criminal activity and violence towards women. But it's impossible to understate how important N.W.A. was to the music landscape in the late 80s, early 90s. And the members of that rap group, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E, they've become synonymous with the West Coast rap sound. Then factor in Suge Knight, Snoop Dogg, Death Row Records, Nate Dogg, Warren G, Tupac. What an ensemble of musicians. And it's hard to forget how the West Coast and East Coast rap scenes feuded in the 90s, remember that, including the untimely deaths of Biggie and Tupac. But did you know that that beef was actually settled right here in Chicago? Ben Westhoff tells the untold story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the birth of West Coast rap in his new book, Original Gangsters. Ben is a former writer for LA Weekly as well as a freelance music journalist. He's also written the book Dirty South, Outkast, Lil Wayne, Soulja Boy, and the Southern Rappers That Reinvented Hip Hop. He's in town for a reading at Volumes Book Cafe, 1474 North Milwaukee, tomorrow night. It's a pleasure to have Ben at the big table here in studio. Ben, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thanks for having me,
What a
Justin.
Book. I mean, I've been talking about the first hour. I feel like I had 24 hours in your words. I mean, it's just been like I looked up last night at 2 o'clock in the morning. I was like, uh-oh. I've been reading for far too long. But what compelled you to write this book? Because this is a story that, with Straight Outta Compton and others, I mean, the West Coast rap scene has been covered.
Yeah, I was a huge fan of this music when I was in high school, and albums like Dr. Dre's The Chronic and Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style came out, and it was like the biggest thing in my high school. And I became a journalist, and I was working in L.A., and I got the chance to interview a lot of my idols. I got to meet Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, Ice Cube, Ice-T, people like that. And the thing was, as a journalist, not just a music critic, but as a music journalist, I knew I could go a lot deeper. And I really poured through the court records. I interviewed everyone I could find. I interviewed people in jail, yeah, gang members. And I knew there was a lot more to the story just because things were so insanely crazy during that era.
Well, the story starts with N.W.A., which is what we mentioned with the movie Straight Outta Compton. But it really starts with Eazy-E, who was the man who put together N.W.A. and sort of was the star of and really the origin story of West Coast rap.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Eazy was, when you think of N.W.A. and you think of who they are with the sort of the violent imagery, the sort of gang related themes, that came from Eazy. Now, Dr. Dre hated gangs. Ice Cube came up in a relatively well-to-do family, and the other members weren't really into the scene like Eazy, but Eazy sold crack cocaine. He was a member of the Crips, and he wasn't a rapper at first. His idea was that the other guys would kind of take what his style and run with it.
This was a business opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. He took his money that he made selling crack and wanted to go legit. But Dr. Dre heard his voice. He saw his image, and he said, "You know, you should really give this a try." And it all kind of launched from there.
You know, it is interesting because one of the, I'm reading back through here, and I, you know, I think we're of the same age in the way that, you know, NWA was a big part of my generation, my childhood. There and all of the controversy surrounding it, from parental guidance notices on the records and everything in between, politicians speaking out. But there really was sort of this glorification of guns, drugs, and violence. And you're right, Eazy-E was all of that. I mean, for as much as there's storylines about, you know, people just sort of being entertainers and not necessarily thugs or criminals, this was the real deal.
Yeah, Eazy-E, they didn't like the term gangster rap. They preferred to call themselves reality rappers. And the way NWA saw it was they were just going to call it like they saw it, like life really was. And this was the crack era. This was the era where the Crips and the Bloods were at war with each other, and homicide violence was at like an all-time high practically in L.A. So they weren't sensationalizing it all that much. They were kind of telling what was going on. And with Eazy, it was about, he wasn't trying to preach, you know. There's a lot of this, like, at the end of the after school special, they tell you, but kids, drugs and guns are bad.
Right.
And Eazy was not having that.
It's fascinating too, because Pete and I were talking about it just before we started this hour, the concept that there was so much discord and chaos around relationships in the communities of you know, the West, and I'm thinking in LA, Inglewood, or
yeah,
South Central
Compton,
LA,
South Central,
Compton,
yeah.
with police, and there, you know, NWA had a lot of had a huge hit off of Straight Outta Compton, but they also had a lot of lyrics that were about their relationship with the police. It's interesting to think about that almost 30 years ago, that was a big sort of, that was a huge thread through the music that was being produced and performed by rappers in African-American communities.
Yeah, absolutely. NWA had F the Police, and they've had all these protests in recent years in places like Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, you know, with these shootings of unarmed black men by white police. And F the Police by NWA is still being played. You still hear it coming out of cars nowadays. It was the soundtrack for the LA riots. And then after that, of course, there was Ice-T with Cop Killer,
right,
which was even more controversial and almost brought down the whole Time Warner company when that came out.
Ben Westhoff's book is Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. It's a great book, and it really does sort of capture this moment, this generation that, I mean, it takes me back to being, you know, a 16-year-old kid and how much of this was a part of the diet of mainstream America and how it got there. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a quick break here on The Download, and we'll continue with Ben. Stay with us.
Brothers out there flaking and perpetrating but scared to kick reality.
Man, you've been doing all this dope producing. You ain't had a chance to show them what time it is.
So what you want me to do?
I'm expressing with my full capabilities, and now I'm living in correctional facilities, cause some don't agree with
Ben Westhoff's my guest in studio here on 720 WGN. We're talking about the book, Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. Love that this song is the one we're playing here, because it brings up, and I want to talk about this, because we'll talk a little bit later about, these guys are writing raps for each other. You know, when you think of the way rap music is written, you think that Dr. Dre is writing his story and he puts it down. But these are, I remember sort of making a mental note that, you know, that was a Dr. Dre rap written by Ice Cube.
Probably Ice Cube.
Yeah, but the idea being that they wrote each other's kind of stories and raps, and it's not necessarily what you think of, that's just this one rapper just always writing his story. There's a lot of ghostwriting that goes into rap.
Yeah, Dr. Dre in particular, he's always had the producer's ear. And for him, the whole song has different instruments, and the rapping is just one of those instruments. So he's had people like the DOC, kind of the unofficial sixth member of NWA, and Ice Cube, Jay-Z, everybody is written for him over the years.
It's interesting because there's been so much made in hip-hop about some of the current stars, whether it be Kanye West or Drake, sort of getting into beefs about not writing their own material. And it's interesting to look back at some of the pioneers of this music, and they never said that they wrote necessarily the lyrics that they were rapping.
Yeah, Eazy-E certainly didn't either. The DOC kind of crafted him into a character who was supposed to be kind of like Flavor Flav from Public Enemy, sort of tough, but with sort of comic relief aspect to him.
Yeah. Ben, it's interesting because a lot of this music obviously played well. I mean, it's so interesting about Skateland and the places in South Central that communities really came after this reality rap. They really loved it. But it wasn't until it got to, I mean, it was the kind of music that really went mainstream. And mainstream, I guess, means getting into the hands of young white kids in Minnesota like yourself or myself in Chicago or wherever, where they had never heard anything like this. And talk about that experience, because that's really where NWA and West Coast rap exploded, the idea of white kids in the Midwest and places, other places listening to it.
Yeah, I think it was surprising at first to the people distributing this music that it was so popular with white kids. But my group of friends in Minnesota, we, you know, it was just part of the culture. And we thought of Compton as a place that was dangerous, but was like the epitome of cool somehow. And we, you know, it was rebellious music. It was the same way that our parents tried to shock their parents by listening to the Rolling Stones. We listened to NWA and the Chronic and things like that, that had the parental warning stickers. And it was our way of kind of, I don't want to say fetishizing another culture, but there certainly was some of that. And, you know, we imitated the styles and put up these ridiculous gang signs. And it's embarrassing to talk about it. It's not very politically correct, but I think it appealed because the music was so great ultimately.
There's a lot of, you know, you kind of underscore a little bit when you talk about, you know, the reaction to the music, to the gangster rap, especially the West Coast gangster rap. There was a lot of political posturing. I mean, it's funny to read Dan Quayle and Tipper Gore, and we all remember that. But there was a lot of sort of, this is dangerous music, and they're writing about, or they're rapping about things that, you know, that we shouldn't have in our society. But then on the other side of town, or in the other side of the dial, you had bands like Guns N' Roses, or some of the sort of hair metal bands rapping about this, or not rap, but singing about the same concepts, misogynistic lyrics, all that kind of stuff. But there wasn't that. So there's these hints of like sort of double standard hypocrisy and this underlying racism when it comes to this kind of music.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was all kind of highlighted when the FBI wrote a letter to NWA. Basically, it was very oddly worded, but they were objecting to the song F the Police. And it was pretty much unprecedented for the FBI to take a stand.
They didn't say they were going to arrest them. They didn't say anything. They just said, we don't like this song.
Yeah, it was basically they were trying to intimidate them. And the group members ultimately, though, were very thankful for that letter because they publicized it and they were convinced that they sold a million more records because of it.
Yeah. One of the things that, I mean, similar with musicians, but it really does play when we talked about this being reality rap. There were a lot of issues that, you know, as I mentioned in the lead, you know, the movie, which I saw Straight Outta Compton, just kind of glossed over the negative aspects of some of these bands and these artists and these, and when it comes to misogynistic lyrics and domestic violence against women. A lot of times you'll hear the rappers say, oh, it's just, we're rapping about this, we're using street language. But in this case, this was some really nasty stuff, especially particularly with Dr. Dre.
Yeah, Dr. Dre has been accused by four different women of domestic abuse. And I was able to find someone who had never been reported. Her name was Lisa Johnson. She's the mother of three of Dr. Dre's children. And she says that he beat her constantly, you know, regularly when they were together, including when she was pregnant in the 80s. And her allegations were substantiated by some court documents and also an eyewitness. So there was also, most famously, a television host named Dee Barnes, and Dr. Dre beat her at a party with a lot of witnesses. And we talk about in the book how some bodyguards allegedly like kept people away, so who were trying to interject to help her. And she ultimately took him to court and he got probation and community service, but the other women didn't. So it was, there wasn't really a lot known about this until Straight Outta Compton came out, the movie, last year. And he, like you were saying, he really glossed over it, didn't have any of that in the movie. And a lot of people objected to that. And so that's when all this stuff really.
And it's interesting, too, because he's been on record talking about it. He kind of had a little bit of an apology around the movie. Like, he came out and you use it in the book, just as sort of like, what I did back then was bad, and I'm sorry for who I hurt. But along the way, there wasn't a lot of statements that Dr. Dre would make to these allegations saying, oh, no, I did not do this. He just kind of said, you know, deal with it.
Yeah, and the other group members in NWA really made some alarming statements about Dee Barnes, like she deserved it and things like that. So it and when he made his apology, a lot of people didn't think it went far enough. He didn't name specific people that he was apologizing to. Like, for example, Michelle A., his old girlfriend, who was an R&B singer, very successful in her own right, just came out with a biopic that lays out all her allegations against him, the beatings, and so that she's finally getting her say.
It's interesting, especially when you think about not just, I mean, obviously domestic violence, but the criminal charges, the gun charges, the drug charges that are on these guys. Not to mention, I mean, early on you set the stage for at least for Dre and for Eazy-E to have, I mean, I think they fathered 10 to 12 different children each, all different moms,
yeah,
all
I
the
think,
way across.
Yeah. I think Dre and Eazy had 10 children. And with Eazy, when he died of AIDS in 1995, there was a lot of concern that would some of the children be test positive? Would some of the mothers of the children? But none of them actually did. And that was strange because it stoked some conspiracy theories that he didn't actually have AIDS. So that's something that my book, Original Gangsters, goes into a great deal, is kind of all this 11th hour strangeness, yeah, right before he died.
Oh, it's so, and they kind of, they do a real quick sort of movie version of that in Hollywood where he gets a cough and the next thing you know, they're all crying. But there's a lot that went into that because it was such a strange time. I want to talk about, you know, we're going to take a break and get the news with Rob. I want to talk about the other players in your book, most notably Tupac Shakur. Obviously, the East Coast, West Coast feud really centered around how he sort of stepped up. I mean, obviously dying in a violent feud, as well as Biggie in the East Coast, and how that feud sort of was settled here in Chicago. So we'll talk about that. Ben Westhoff is the author of The Original Gangstas, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. He's my guest at the big table. Stay with us.
It's time to kill for our women, time to heal our women, be real to our women. And if we don't, we'll have a race of babies that will hate the ladies that make the babies. And since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one. So will the real men get up? I know you're fed up, ladies, but keep your head up.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Ben Westhoff. He is the author of Original Gangstas, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. He's going to be at Volumes Book Cafe at 1474 North Milwaukee tomorrow night, hosted by Kevin Koval. You know, as we, you know, move on from NWA and the stories of NWA, Dr. Dre makes a name for himself with the album The Chronic, considered one of the best rap albums of all time. Snoop Dogg, it plays a big, prominent role in this book. And it's interesting because it kind of goes from this sort of reality rap to this G thing, this idea that there's this gangstaism, as you just sort of say. But the idea that you don't necessarily, it's not gangsters rapping, it's almost like a feel instead. That's sort of what came out of it.
Yeah, Dr. Dre hated gangs, and he had been, you know, talking trash about them on his early music, but on Nothing But a G Thing, songs like that, the way I put it was that gangsterism became like literally a posture. Like, it was sort of the way he stood. It's about standing up for yourself. It's about not taking crap from anyone.
It's less about colors and Bloods and Crips and more
exactly
about the feel.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Dr. Dre, I mean, you think back to even those videos, I mean, everything, that it almost equates, because Snoop Dogg came from gang life.
Yeah, definitely. And Snoop was the one who introduced him to weed, because on the NWA song Express Yourself, which we heard earlier, Dre talks about how he hates weed. But then he did a big reverse course on that.
So let's talk about Snoop Dogg and, more importantly, Death Row Records. You know, it was in the movie as well, Straight Outta Compton, but there was a move from Ruthless Records, which was NWA and Eazy-E and Jerry Heller, to Death Row Records, which was Suge Knight. And that's where this as we know it, the popularizing of the beef came from. This is where more and more we saw Death Row Records taking, not only having diss tracks on records, but then being brawls at convention centers and fights at award shows. I mean, it really went from one thing to another pretty quick.
Yeah. At the center of the beef was Eazy-E and Dr. Dre themselves, who used to be best friends, but Dr. Dre released this diss tracks against Eazy on The Chronic. And at this point, they were actually living near each other, as I report in Original Gangsters. They lived in the same like private, wealthy community, and they'd see each other on the street now again, and kind of like Eazy said that Dre would sort of duck his head down. But it became a little more real. It wasn't just about disses on record like rap has always had.
And that's been something that from the origins of rap, as people who may not be familiar, the last track of a album was almost reserved for people to name check or diss on other rappers. And it was a tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And so this became kind of a transition where things got more and more real. And that would really culminate with Tupac Shakur, and he was assigned to Death Row, and they basically initiated a war with their East Coast rival, Bad Boy Records, which was led by Puff Daddy, and the most famous rapper was Biggie Smalls.
So then, and that, you know, as we said, the diss tracks became real. There was a spillover. First, it was Ruthless Records and Death Row Records in L.A. that would find each other on the street in some form and have some sort of all-out violent brawl. Then it became the East Coast and the West Coast bat. As you say in the book, it's almost a misnomer to say it was East Coast, West Coast. It was two record labels.
Yeah, exactly. It was Death Row and Bad Boy. And it all started when Tupac was shot, not fatally, the first time in 1994. And he began to believe that Biggie, who had been his friend, knew about the shooting advance, knew he was going to be set up. And so he went on basically a tirade against Biggie and sort of initiated this dispute, which got more and more serious until Tupac was murdered in Las Vegas in 1996. And then Biggie was murdered 6 months later. Now, those murders are still unsolved. But as I explore in my book, there's a lot of reason to believe that the two labels were involved with one or both of those murders.
You know, there's a lot of theories and conspiracy theories around the concept, but there really does all lines sort of lead back to the different labels really had to do with essentially assassinating the other rapper.
Yeah, there's a cop named Greg Kading who worked on these cases for LAPD, and his theory is that Suge Knight basically paid a member of his entourage to kill Biggie, and that Puff Daddy may have paid someone to kill Tupac. Now, that case is less certain. It's kind of like this guy who says he was involved, his word versus Puffy's word. Puffy denies it, but there's a lot going on there, definitely.
Now, this is where the story turns to Chicago, and you know, be sort of teasing out the idea, because it really surrounds, and if you're a fan of rap, you are probably already picked it out. If you're not, you'd be surprised that the Nation of Islam and Louis Farrakhan played a big role in the early days of West Coast rap. He became almost a religious, spiritual leader or confidant to bands like N.W.A., to Ice Cube. There's a relationship between the Nation of Islam and the music.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a time when politicians, religious leaders, both black and white, were dissing hip-hop, especially gangster rap, and had no time for it at all. But Farrakhan really respected these performers, and the Nation of Islam would provide security. Like when Eazy-E was dying, the Nation of Islam was right there at his bedside to try to keep him safe. And when it came to after Tupac and Biggie's murders, Farrakhan personally put together a peace summit here in Chicago. Now, this was a really scary time for everyone in hip-hop. Everyone thought they might be next. That, you know, these were the two biggest stars at the height of their fame, gunned down with thousands of people around, you know, and still unsolved. So Farrakhan brought all these people together. He brought together representatives from Death Row, including Snoop Dogg, along with Ice Cube, who had a beef with Common.
You're in Chicago.
You're in Chicago. Brought in people from the South, people from the East, and basically put them all in a room together. And he was like, you guys aren't leaving till you.
And he did it in his Hyde Park in the palace, the where he lives.
Yep, exactly.
And so he brought all these rappers together. And it's kind of unknown. I mean, you talk about this, that it's a very discreet meeting. It wasn't something publicized where they had a press conference after the fact, but it wasn't this sort of, you know, day four of the, you know, the summit. I mean, it was really about airing the grievances and sort of breaking down what these beefs have become.
Yeah, this was not a publicity stunt at all. This was people who were generally afraid that hip hop might not survive all this carnage, and they knew that the music was on an unsustainable path. So Snoop Dogg, actually, he had been maybe the toughest of all these guys, like a serious Crip with wearing his blue bandana, but he knew he had to make a change, and he sort of spearheaded this effort. And Ice Cube also was willing to be like, you know, I really shouldn't have picked a fight with you, Common. That was pretty dumb. A lot of people thought that Common sort of won their lyrical diss battle anyway. So I think Ice Cube realized it was time to throw in the towel.
It's also interesting to see the omissions, because Dr. Dre was not involved, because Dr. Dre, I would say Dr. Dre in your book is one of the central characters, because at this point, you know, you think of him involved in these beasts, but he wasn't. He was withdrawn. He spent some time in jail off a DUI when he had a parole, but he stayed away from this stuff. And surprising to me, and it was an eye-opener, you know, he hasn't done much at all collaborating with Tupac, was not really involved in some of the sort of, you know, those relationships that we know today to be the sort of the big beefs.
Yeah, well, at the time that Tupac was joining Death Row, Dr. Dre was ready to leave Death Row. Suge Knight, who was the head of Death Row, was engaged in all sorts of craziness, and there were gang members in the studios. There were people getting beat up, and Dr. Dre just wanted to make music. He didn't want any part of this. So he bowed out, and it was really Tupac and Suge who were all about the aggression against the East Coast and things like that. But meanwhile, Dr. Dre left Death Row, the label he helped start, which was selling, you know, $100 million company with nothing. And he basically just said, you can have it. I want to start my own label. I want out of this. And then soon after, he discovered Eminem and really made a go of it himself.
In a whole different way. You know, Ben, the book is called Original Gangsters, and it's a book that really tells it tells the untold story, and it does, because it reads like an investigative report. I mean, you go into court documents. He really sort of set up chapters of these entertainers' lives. You interviewed a lot of these guys. They gave you access, some in some probably quicker version than others, and it's been over the last couple years. What's the through line? I mean, are they excited to talk about the glory days of the West Coast rap days? I mean, what's the takeaway from a lot of the players that are in this book that you had a chance to talk to?
Well, I think it's funny in a way that now we've come to, you know, when I was growing up, you had classic rock radio, and now we've gotten to the point where it's classic hip hop radio, and there's all sorts of channels. And this era, you know, it was dangerous. It was the crack era. There was high violence, but now there's almost sort of a nostalgia towards it. And, you know, the guys that I talk to are really proud of even the peripheral players being involved with this music and this movement that still resonates. Last year you had Straight Outta Compton, the movie, was a huge hit. NWA got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's a Tupac movie coming out. So this era is really as big a part of the public consciousness as it's ever been.
I was going to say, I mean, for you, you wrote the Dirty South book, which looks at some tremendous rappers, Lil Wayne, Outkast. When you think of the West Coast scene that was created here that is now having such success in, as we all reminisce about it, when you think of the canon of hip-hop as we know it, where does this scene stand? I mean, is it the biggest scene that's ever come out of hip-hop?
Well, I don't know if it's the biggest. It might be among the most lucrative, you know, because nowadays, because of digital downloading and streaming, no one makes any money at all. And this era was at a time when Suge Knight could buy like $10,000 diamond pendants for everyone and their mothers, literally. But I think this was the most exciting era of hip hop to me, at least, because the music was great. And the behind-the-scenes story were so insane. So that's what I'd put it.
You know, listeners to this program will know that we have a lot of different artists in Chicago, some hip-hop artists who will come on. And we've talked about different scenes. Do you think that there can be another scene like this? I mean, we've seen a little bit with the drill scene here in Chicago with Chief Keef and others sort of doing this reality rap, rapping about the things around them. Do you see what's old again becomes new when it comes to hip hop.
Absolutely. I think that the drill scene here in Chicago is really a direct descendant of what Easy started. Easy made it okay to rap about whatever you want, really. You didn't have to try to sugarcoat it. And that's, you know, you wouldn't call what's happening today gangster rap necessarily, but it has a lot of the same themes and it has the same sort of like don't give an F attitude that I think Easy would appreciate.
The last thing, you know, it's so interesting because you think about all of these stories that, you know, you report in the book, whether it be in clubs, altercations, situations like you mentioned with Dr. Dre in the club with D. Barnes. These are all situations that happened before social media, you know, and you wonder if today this radical, really reckless behavior would be corrected quickly because of social media and being able to put on Instagram and other places like, look what I just saw. I mean, do you think that you can have this kind of reckless behavior in a world where now everything is documented?
I think definitely someone like Dr. Dre, who's accused by four different women of beating, would have been taken to task a lot sooner. That's one thing. One of the women he allegedly beat, Terry B, says that Eazy-E and Jerry Heller paid her for her silence, and that's the kind of thing I don't think could happen anymore. But yeah, one thing I think about when thinking about this era is that there's probably a ton of even crazier stuff that we just will never know about.
We'll never know. Ben Westhoff is a journalist, a music journalist, and he's the author of Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. He's going to be at Volumes Books Cafe in Wicker Park, 1474 North Milwaukee, tomorrow night, reading from the book and signing. Ben, thanks so much for coming in and being in the big table.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Justin.
1, 2, 3 into the folks. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the door, ready to make an entrance, so back on up, cause you know we're about to rip this up. Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Compton and Long Beach together, now you know you in trouble. Ain't nothing but a G-Bang, baby. Too low depth.
I'll never listen to this music the same way after reading this book. I'm telling you, man. It's so interesting. Like Snoop was a kid from Long Beach, and it's almost stereotypical to be like, oh yeah, Snoop was a gangbanger who sold drugs. think about like where they're at now, where Snoop Dogg is a spokesman. I mean, he's a celebrity. He's an entertainer. Like he's a pitch man.
Pals around with Martha Stewart.
Right. The thing from the days in Long Beach. I mean, hey. 630 says you can't compare today's rappers or hip hop artists to Dre, Easy, Q, Pac, and the West and East Coast rappers. It's just disrespectful. I don't know. I think that they're good, but I do think that the rappers today, including Kanye West, do have similar or, if not, better.
Kendrick Lamar,
who is a Dr. Dre protege. I grew up in metal. This 815 and NWA and Public Enemy plus a Lynch Mob were popular crossover music back then. I think metal fans actually helped the rap scene.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Wax is for Anthrax.
Yeah, right. I think there's something to that, you know, because there was I think that kind of concept of being rebellious music has been talked about. This idea that it wasn't necessarily about, you know, as I think a lot of people mischaracterize why young white kids were listening to that music, like, oh, you just want to be black. It wasn't that. It was that they liked the rebellious style, that they were saying things that weren't allowed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's traditional in music. I mean, Elvis Presley, right? The Beatles, Rolling Stones. And you think about all the bands in metal was very similar. I mean, we're not talking about hair metal type stuff, but Guns N' Roses and even some of the more Metallicas and stuff, they said things that, you know, or at least brought music to a different level. So really interesting. I'm glad to read that book, man. Like I said, that was 24 hours of some sheer West Coast rap. Like, I might have to take a week off from my West Coast rap Spotify channel. But you know what was really great? Is that I read this book with my phone you know, so I read it with I had my phone on me. So whenever I got to a point where they're like, Ben would be like, and then this track came out and it was a big distance. I would look it up.
Go back and listen to it.
Yeah. And so you're like listening back to Ice Cube or Dre and your stuff that's not the norm, you know, not the hits. And there's this one great this whole thing about Terry B. It was a white woman, that Eazy-E signed rapper, first sort of white female rapper in the late 80s. And she had a diss track and she dissed Dr. Dre on it because Dre wanted to produce a record because everything that Ruthless Records Eazy-E did, Dre produced, but she wouldn't have it. And so she dissed him on the track, right? And it was a famous kind of track, but I had never heard it. So I went back and listened to it. And it was terrible. It was terrible. She should have had Dre produce it. But it was really interesting because in the story, which is really evil, is that he got upset. Usually, you know, especially at that time, rappers didn't get that upset, but because maybe there was personal and because she was a woman, whatever it was, he got upset and then they were at a some sort of record release party or whatever and he hit her, like in front of everybody. And you're just like, yeah, that's just not, he's very... I would say that Dr. Dre is a pretty lucky guy in the sense that he had this despicable, deplorable behavior that just was missed. Or at the time in the 80s, mm-hmm. It was okay to do that. If he did that today, he wouldn't sell any records. He'd be in jail.
Yeah.
And the idea that he somehow was able to... This was before The Chronic. This was before now when he's on the Beats by Dre headphones and the Apple commercials and Kendrick Lamar's in the studio and he's working on stuff. Or he's got a Sprite or whatever that is, right? This was, you know, so all of this behavior was dismissed. And he had a career, a multi-million-dollar career after that. Anyway, coming up, John Glazer, Jess Godwin. We got a good show coming up. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9:30, right after the news, we're going to talk with John Glazer. John Glazer is the man behind John Glazer Loves Gear, which is on True TV right now. He's also the star of Delocated on Adult Swim. I think he's on like 19 Adult Swim shows. He's also a longtime award-winning writer for Conan O'Brien. He did Late Night with Conan O'Brien back in the days when it was at NBC. And a Second City star here in Chicago back in the 80s, early 90s. John Glazer is going to join us coming up. Also in 10 o'clock, Character Flaws, best of improv sketch characters from people like Susan Messing, Rachel Mason, Robin Scott, Sandy Marshall, all going to be with us coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, just recently, the 9th annual Three Arts Awards were presented. It's an unrestricted award presented to women artists, artists of color, and artists with disabilities working in the performing, teaching, and visual arts. In studio with me tonight is Chicago singer-songwriter Jess Godwin. Godwin just received the award, which gives artists a substantial sum of money, $25,000 to be exact, to work on new projects. It's unrestricted, so you can do anything you want with it. Godwin has been performing original music for some time now here in Chicago. She produced an album and 5 EPs. In 2014, she started the Godwin Anthology, a series of DIY videos dedicated to people in her life that she loves.
Been strong, but now I'm weak. Time taken to defeat. Tongue tied, I forgot how to speak. But I don't mind it when you're next to me. Oh, we got time. It's a good time to be.
That's a track called Be. Her latest project, Muses, takes conversations with friends, puts them to song. She's had her music featured on the hit show Dance Moms. She's been on stage at Chicago Theater with Broadway star Kristen Chenoweth, but right now she is in studio with us, Jess Godwin. Thanks for being here. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Congrats on the award.
Thank you.
So talk about this. I mean, when it's unrestricted, do you feel like, I mean, because most of the grants and awards that I know are ones that are restricted, ones that are like,
yeah.
You have to, hey, you're going to win this money, but you have to make a piece of pottery or whatever it is. But I mean, talk about the world of winning awards and grants and things like that when it comes to restricted and unrestricted.
So this is the first time I've ever received a grant before. So I think I didn't realize how special the unrestricted thing was until I started researching other grant opportunities. And it was amazing. When I got the phone call, I cried a lot because I wasn't expecting it. And I was incredibly grateful to receive so much money. But I immediately started thinking of all the things I had to make to show them that I was making good things for them.
This is an investment, right?
Exactly. But they, you know, they assured me 3Arts was amazing. They were like, you know, this is just to show you that we appreciate what you're doing. This is to show you, like, you know, to give you love. And this is for anything you need to use it for. Well, so I, you know, I fixed my car and I worked on smart projects and I paid up my credit card bill. And I, you know, I did a bunch of different
stuff,
things.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you've worked, you've done albums, you've done EPs, you've played all over. I mean, it's interesting because a lot of your music, specifically the stuff like from the anthology or even Muses, which I just mentioned, you know, it's project based.
Yeah.
It's almost like an art project. It's music that's done in a way that you're finding sort of a theme and inspirations. Talk about producing music and writing music and why you move in that direction as opposed to just writing sort of disparate songs.
You know, I think it's definitely from my theater background. I think the best kind of actor makes the scene about the other. And I also think the best kind of person in life makes it about the other. I'm just a firm believer in having a service-based life. And I find that when I focus my music and put it on about another person, it makes for better music. And it stops me from trying to like write hits, you know, because when I start to try to write hits, things go downhill.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, for you, and I'm fascinated as a singer-songwriter in Chicago. Chicago's a great place to be a musician, a tough place at the same time.
Oh, for sure.
If you're attempting to have a world in professional music, there are opportunities here, but a lot of musicians are going to go to the coast. They're going to go to Los Angeles, New York to find work.
For sure.
What keeps you here in Chicago, and does staying in Chicago change your sort of outlook on what kind of musician you want to be?
You know, Chicago feels like my home, and this is my community. I have a great network here. I have a lot of people that I'm surrounded by that inspire me. I mean, I just know so many wonderful theater artists and visual artists and music artists that are doing really, really great work that, you know, aren't getting recognition for it, but it doesn't stop them from doing good work. And that pushes me to continue to do good work that, that, like, I really, truly believe in, which doesn't mean that I'm signed to a label out in New York. I'm signed to Razor and Tie as a publisher. Mm-hmm. And then I'm, in talks with some people out in LA as well. But I think there's a constant balance between trying to keep the artist side of me and then also try to figure out how to make it commercial
right
at the same time.
You want to
buy food.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Jess Godwin in studio with me, singer songwriter here in Chicago. And one of the things I've struggled when looking at your work, and I say looking on purpose because it's music, but a lot of your work is video based.
Yeah.
A lot of it is projects that you have on your website, Godwin Anthology. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested in how you classify yourself. Do you consider yourself a musician or do you consider yourself an artist?
An artist. Yeah. I think so. And I've really come into being a more visual artist in the past 2 years, and it really came out of necessity. I worked with a lot of different producers, and I shot music videos with professional people, and, you know, hired really great photographers, and I got to a point where I couldn't afford it anymore, and I wanted to keep making things.
Right.
So 2 years ago, I started to force myself to produce my own music, and I started Googling lighting on YouTube and trying to figure out how to light sets, and bought myself a camera.
Wow.
And then I started building these sets, these videos. Like, you know, they look very DIY because I make them in my bedroom.
But they don't. Look DIY.
Thank you.
I mean, for someone who said it's 2 years ago, you're Googling lighting plots and you know, learning how to use a camera. I mean, these are very, it feels like you had training, like you had schooling in it. The idea that it's almost, there's this sort of, the video element, it sort of rivals the music.
Oh, well, thank you. I've going to Michael's and buying paper flowers and then trying to figure out how to make like a flower world around me is just brings me a lot of joy. And what's so great about doing this is it's helped me write better music, because I start to think about music like, if I'm writing a song, I'm like, how can I make the song visual? So I'm thinking about that from the very beginning. And I've also like expanded my sound in different ways, where because I do a lot of live looping now, I need to figure out how to keep the song simple and figure out how to harmonize with a lot of my melodies. So it's also helped me write better melodies, because I start a song and say, how can I loop this? I think I taught at Columbia College, where I found it. You went to.
I did.
I taught this freshman foundation course. I co-taught with Christy Bramlett. She's an amazing, amazing theater teacher. And we encouraged the freshmen, even if they were actors, we encouraged them to learn how to be directors and lighting designers and to free write. Because, you know, if you're going to be an artist, you have to be an artist in every sense of the word. And it's just going to make you better at what you do.
Is for you to have your first sort of discipline be music.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, you did theater as well.
Yeah.
But, and you really do lived a life of sort of crossing over mediums and being able to express yourself in different ways and different senses.
Uh-huh.
Is there fear in that? I mean, is there fear as an artist to say, oh, I'm going to learn how to do video, but you know what? It's difficult to do video because I don't know it, and it won't match the intensity I have in the other places that I've learned and that I have experience in.
Absolutely. I mean, it's frustrating. I never liked being bad at things as a kid or as an adult. And I, you know, with the anthology videos, I think that every single video that I made, because I was, you know, doing single camera takes and lighting my face and doing it all on my own, I think I cried every single time I had to make a video. But what was really cool is coming around to this concept that if you're making something, it doesn't matter if it's good or not. What matters is that you're making it, and it comes from a place of love and honesty. And if the more that I hold on to that, the less I care about whether or not I'm making something good.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is that a lot of people listening right now might say, okay, well, I need to, you know, I'm a musician, and maybe I'm at a point where I don't have someone who can produce my music, so I need to produce it myself. But I don't even know how to start in that way. I want to do my own videos I have some ideas. I just don't know where to start. And it's so intimidating to do so that I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I would encourage these people just to start. I had the show with So Far Sounds last night. I don't know if you've...
Yeah, those guys were on. They came on and we talked about that. For those listening, this is the surprise shows where you sign up at the sites and then you don't know where it's going to be, and you show up and it's in the living room somewhere.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting, yeah.
I was their resident artist this past month, and they're a great team, and everyone they bring in other shows, everyone's just so cool. But I've moved on to this looping stuff with my iPad because I can't afford a band every time I play out. And I like being the lead singer and the backup singer and the other backup singer and the choir all at the same time, because I'm a little narcissistic, maybe.
Okay.
But I had a couple young women come up to me after I performed, and they were like, I don't play any instruments, but I was in an a cappella group, and I just saw you do all this on your iPad with just your voice, and maybe I could start doing that. I'm like, yeah, I think... I would encourage people to think outside the box and think about what they're good at and how to produce around that. Because I play instruments. I play piano. I play the uke. But my music is vocal driven, because that's what I do.
Right.
I'm a vocalist. So it was exciting to like look at young women and say, yeah, you can.
Well, you got the Three Arts Award, which is an unrestricted grant. And I guess it begs the question about artists and musicians here in Chicago, if they are supported, if there's enough places where a Jess Godwin can find a sustainable revenue source or resources to be able to produce this stuff, and not just produce creative projects, but be able to live in a city like this to be able to stay and produce those projects.
You know, I look at all of my artist friends out there on Facebook, like just grinding every day. And we all have to have lots of different little side jobs in order to do what we love. It would be wonderful. It would be amazing if there were more things like Three Arts out there, because I know there's a lot of money in this city. And I really, truly believe that this would be a better city and a better world if more money was given to artists to make what they make, because like art makes the world better. Like, I really believe that.
Jess Godwin is an artist. And a singer-songwriter as well. You can find her work at GodwinAnthology.com. That's where you can find the Godwin Anthology. You can also find the Muses Project and also more information on how to contact. And congratulations on the Three Arts Award.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming to the studio. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, John Glazer is going to be in. He's going to be here. We're going to talk about his show, John Glazer Loves Gear. Glazer was in a show at Second City called Pinata Full of Bees, which is sort of known to be one of the most influential, if not one of the best reviews that was ever on stage. It was the mid-90s, 1995, I believe. Adam McKay, the director of all the Will Ferrell movies. Rachel Dratch, who was on SNL. Scott Adsit, of course, one of the biggest stars Chicago's Second City's ever seen. John Glazer is become sort of that great comedic genius on Adult Swim. He did Delocated, which was essentially a reality show about a family in the witness protection program. So he had to wear a mask the entire time. And he was at the center of all those goofy but just sublime bits on the Conan O'Brien show that used to be on, you know, late night after Jay Leno. You remember those sketches that they would do and those characters that would come out? John Glazer was a big part of that. So we'll talk with John Glazer coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. This is Chicago's very own 720 WG in Chicago. I don't necessarily need to read that until the top of the hour.
I'm sorry. I was in it, man.
You were in
I was following you.
Pull out. Pull up. Pull up.
That's all right. I had a similar experience at my 8:30.
Did you?
Couldn't spit it out quite at the end there.
I don't know. It's just like,
hello. I tell you what, man. I find it hard to read at a third grade level sometimes. I really do.
Oh, my. What a night. I tell you, man, I blame it on the weather. The fact that it got cold. Now it takes a little while. We got to do a little bit more warm-ups.
Been a good show tonight, though, man. I was really interested in that book interview.
Are you a gangster rap guy?
You know what? I am not, but in saying that, there was obviously growing up there were musicians that I liked.
Yeah,
I mean, there were rap artists that I did like. So not quite as into it, you know, as you are.
But
not
you're
knowledgeable.
Right. I mean, we kind of talked about the idea that could you imagine those kids? I mean, the kids from NWA and whatever, and right now with all the cell phones and Instagram and videos everywhere they went, they would. I mean, I don't know if they would last. These stories are so reckless. That's what really gets me about the book. I'm like, I can't imagine how any group, any musician could live the way that they were living and not be destroyed by the media attention. I mean, they kind of look at Kanye West. I mean, he's obviously not doing the things that are being done in this book, but just that pressure, that media attention, everything you do is a scroll on E, everything you put on Instagram, you know, like everything about it is just like overkill.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's an absolute double-edged sword for these guys as well. They need it and crave it, but then you know when you want to get away from it, you can't.
You can't. Yikes. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the first season of John Glazer Loves Gear is up on True TV. The show follows comedian John Glazer as he uses cutting-edge gear for camping, cycling, baseball, or surfing. The only problem with the faux reality show is that Glazer's personal problems keep getting in the way. It's the latest project for John Glazer, who was a longtime writer for Conan O'Brien, as well as a star of the Adult Swim show Delocated, and a writer on Inside Amy Schumer. Glazer was born in Chicago. He cut his teeth on stage at Second City as part of the 1995 main stage show Pinata Full of Bees, alongside Adam McKay, Scott Adsit, and Rachel Dratch, just to name a few. Still considered to be one of the best shows to have ever been produced up at North and Wells. One of my favorites, John Glazer, joins us now. John, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me, although right off the bat, just so my hometown people don't get upset, I was born in Detroit.
You were born in Detroit, really?
I've seen that on IMDb, and I don't care, it's fine, but I know I've seen it on IMDb, born in Chicago, and it's like...
It said born in Chicago, so raised in Michigan, yeah, so, all right.
It's so weird, it's the opposite. I moved to Chicago after college, and I was born in Michigan, went to school in Michigan, and then moved to Chicago after... You wouldn't know, I'm very Midwest. When I talk, I sound Chicago. There's even when we're editing the show right now, there's a lot of stuff. Anytime I feel like my dad, a lot of heavy Midwest going on.
Well, let's talk about the show, John Glazer Loves Gear. You know, this is a great show, and I really got sucked into it because it really is sort of a, you know, just like we see on some of the Discovery Channel and other places, this idea of, hey, you know, gear, we're building a motorcycle. But it also is the secondary line, which is hilarious, is you dealing with your personal life and your relationship with your wife and others around you. Talk about where this idea came from.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say Discovery Channel, because even when I originally had the idea, and when I first came up with it, it was even a smaller idea that I thought could potentially exist in a larger show, whether that be a sketch show or a variety show or whatever. I thought maybe I could do like this kind of gear segment, because it does come from this genuine place of, you know, earnestly loving gear. And gear has a very loose definition. But even when the idea became a bigger idea and became more of a show, its own idea as a show, I thought maybe I would even consider pitching to like Discovery Channel, National Geographic, you know, non-comedy places, because the idea was a little more reality-based and a little more earnest and a little more about the gear, with also some comedy stuff and some content in there as well. And then the more we developed it, it became more and more scripted, which I think to it's better. And we just ended up pitching to True TV, and they really, really responded to it. And here we are. So it just sort of grew over time and evolved from the pitch to even making the pilot and shooting the pilot and editing the pilot and writing the show. Every step it kept evolving to what the show is now.
You know, I watch it, I mean, it's got that, I would say it's almost satirized or even parodies a show. But hearing you, I mean, you really set out to do something at first that was for your love of gear.
Yeah, I really wanted to just do something where I could kind of dive into that and just really do a show about the joy of stuff and the joy of whatever activity it is, whether it's outdoorsy or sports, athletic or none. I mean, we did an episode about dogs and dog gear. You know, there is a joy that every person has, whatever the activity is. I told a friend about the show when I was first pitching it and making it, and she said, oh my God, I love these Japanese pens I'm into right now. You know, the size of the case, and then the little cartridge and the way it slides into the pen and the carry case that it comes in. So you could really pick whatever activity you're into. It could be kitchen and, you know, cooking gear, and all the utensils you buy and all the stuff. And it's about the joy of the little details and just the design and the way you use it and every little definition of it. So, yeah, I was genuinely looking forward to that aspect of it. And I do in this, but I also now, you know, it's expanded to the more scripted stories and the tangents. And that's really fun also.
Well, I mean, you have done so much great stuff in New York City, whether it was, you know, writing for Conan O'Brien or Delocated or even your work with, you know, one-offs, even with Wonder Shows and Vernon, who you've reunited with. Talk about why you chose to go to New York as opposed to L.A. when you were done with your run at Second City.
Well, I got a job right out of Second City, and it was in New York, and that was the Dana Carvey Show, and it was writing for that show, and it was something where I felt like I didn't ever think about being a writer at that time. It just was an opportunity that presented itself, and that particular writing job, I may not have said yes to every writing job that had come up at that time or now even, but I just felt like, oh, I can't turn this one down. It felt too good, and it's the best thing I ever did. I mean, the greatest thing career-wise that happened to me, just to become a writer as well as an actor and have jobs like that come up. So it really came up. It wasn't so much a choice I made as much as a job took me there. And shortly there, after the show got canceled, I just decided to stay for a little bit and try it out, meaning New York. I tried to get a couple jobs there, meaning SNL and Conan. Didn't get them at first. Ended up moving to L.A. And then when I got the Conan job, moved back to New York and then just decided to stay. Even after I left Conan, I just really liked it here and wanted to just try to stay here if I could. And even still to this day, I feel like maybe I'll move to L.A., maybe I'll have to move to L.A., should I move to L.A., but every year I'm able to stay here, and at this point, you know, maybe I'm just here.
You know, I mentioned Vernon Chapman, who did Wonder Shows and you know, does the Art Collective work, but also you've been a presence at UCB at the theater in the early days of doing improvisation with alongside the Upright Citizens Brigade with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey and Horatio Sanz. Talk about how that community, that Chicago community, kind of followed you and it became a place for you to be able to do the work that you did here in Chicago.
It sounds like I was the Pied Piper that led the way, and they all followed me here. Right. I mean, they didn't literally follow me. You know, it was more they came after, of course. And it just became a thing where I think those UCB, that group, just decided to come here. And they came here first before they got their show. And I never talked to them about why they chose New York or if there was a reason they chose New York over L.A., but they did, and the community here, there was a lot of Chicago people on Conan when I got the job, certainly people like Andy Richter, Brian McCann, this guy Dino Stamatopoulos, mm-hmm. Oh, he was before me, a guy named Tommy Blachuk, extremely funny guy, Brian Stack. So there was a lot of Chicago people here, and then when UCB sort of took off, they obviously became this place that people wanted to do comedy at, and so it drew a lot of people here, both from Chicago and elsewhere, but it's great here. Most people now are in LA, at least the people that I came up with. Everyone's kind of moved there, and it's a little strange, but, you know, I've just been able to stay here, and I still love it. I do sometimes feel like, oh, all my friends are there, at least meaning the people that I came up with in Chicago. And sometimes I really miss that. You know, I'll go on Facebook and I'll see, you know, oh, everyone got together with their kids and they're all playing football and, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. Even though we have plenty of friends here from comedy and also just from my kids' schools, you know, there are times where I feel like, oh, that's kind of too bad that I don't get to see a lot of these people on a regular mm-hmm. basis. But there's still enough people like Miriam Tolan, who's in John Glazer Loves Gear.
Yeah, right.
You know, I've known her for years, and her husband, Brian Stack. I don't see Brian as much because he's working at Colbert and busy with that. But, you know, when we were together at Conan, it was really the best. And it's always great to get to see Chicago people and certainly work with them. And so there's still a few people here, but that's sometimes tough. What if I just started crying right now?
We'd give you breath.
The last 5 minutes of this interview should be real-time crying while you just sit there on the phone silently and listen.
We're talking with John Glazer. He's the star of John Glazer Loves Gear, which is on True TV right now. And it wouldn't surprise me, John, because a lot of your work that you've done over the years, from Delocated to we even work on Conan, some of the sketches you did on Late Night with Conan, and also just the way that you've bounced from project to project. I've mentioned the Wonder Shows in a couple times. Love that show. You really have.
That show is great.
I mean, you have a knack for doing something a little bit off the beaten path. I mean, you have the jobs where you were, you know, you're writing for Amy Schumer or other kind of writing gigs. You show up on Girls as well. But you have found a knack or a community in New York that almost gives you the ability to do weird things.
Well, I think I've just been fortunate to, as far as staying in New York and doing shows here, you know, and it's a byproduct of just the environment, meaning there are places now like Adult Swim, which give a home to these sort of stranger, weirder, more creative and inventive ideas. And, you know, I was able to do that from New York, and I'm able to continue to do shows here. So as long as I'm able to do that, I'd stay in New York. I mean, I really love living here. So, you know, it's just a matter of if I'm able to continue doing that or not. And I'd like to think I can, but time will tell. But yeah, it's nice. There are still people like the group, they're called PFFR.
Yeah, right.
That's the production company. You know, that's Vernon Chapman, who you mentioned, and this guy John Lee, and this woman Allison Levy, who comprised that group. And, you know, they're brilliantly funny people. They make their own shows. You know, they did Wonder Shows, and they did the show Xavier Renegade Angel and The Harshy Holler, all on Adult Swim, all the Wonder Shows and on MTV, too. But they're brilliantly funny people and, you know, very, very talented. You know, Vernon writes for South Park. He wrote on Louie. He does a lot of stuff. John Lee directed the latest Pee-wee movie that was on Netflix. Mm. So me and John and Vernon do all the writing together. You know, I hired them when I did Delocated. I had to hire a production company to help with the production side of it, more the logistical side, but they had just started doing that, and it was an easy decision for me because I know them and we have similar sensibilities, and it was a great match, and they've done every show that I've done. So it's really me and John and Vernon, and to a lesser extent Allison, doing all the writing together, and we've been able to do these three shows together, and, you know, we mostly stay in New York. I know Vernon goes to L.A. for South Park, but so we've been able to kind of make it work, and hopefully we'll just continue to do so.
And doing the research for this, you know, I came across a thing where you talked a little bit about the role of drama
in comedy. And I feel in your career, you've done a lot of things where I think of Laird on Girls, where it's a funny character, mm-hmm. but it's based in drama. You don't seem to shy away from the idea of being able to do both, to be able to do drama to get to comedy or do comedy that has drama elements. Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, as far as, you know, what you were saying for the first part of that, you know, I have talked about that before where that's just kind of what I gravitate towards as far as what I like to do. Personally, as far as the performance stuff, the shows that I like to do, like Delocated, even Neon Joe, and certainly this show, the Gear Show, they all are grounded in this kind of dramatic place, and all the comedy comes from the drama and what we like to call the stupidity. So, or all the stupidity comes from the drama. So I just, you know, that just appeals to me. I kind of like rooting and grounding things in that place and then letting it all kind of go from there. It doesn't mean that I don't, you know, don't dislike doing, you know, broad stuff and physical shtick, you know, and whatever. I just happen to have done these three shows, and that just appeals to me as a sensibility. So, but I've always liked doing it, and, you know, thankfully there's an audience for it, and even just similar to these other answers, I hope I can continue to do so.
When I look back and I think back to Pinata Full of Bees back in Chicago and even some of the clips that Second City has put online from that show, there are elements that, you know, there is this deep breath, if you will. There's you know, not every line is sort of going for a joke, the stuff that you're in. I'm thinking about the scene with the wheelchairs. This is a good example of yeah. One that, you know, there's a good stretch in that scene for a minute or so where there's just not even an attempt at a laugh. You're really trying to set the scene, the dramatic elements in that scene. So it's something that seems to be with you for a long time, over 20 years.
Yeah, certainly the wheelchair scene and song is a really good example. Some of the other stuff in Pinata, I mean, I just enjoy it. I guess I found what I liked and tried to hone in on it, and I've been lucky to get to do it.
You know, I mentioned it's one of the best shows, and continues when critics look back on the history of Second City, they look at Pinata Full of Bees. We had Scott Adsit was on the show talking about the same thing, this idea that what Second City was doing before Pinata Full of Bees is much different than what they've done after Pinata Full of Bees. Do you think back to that show and think about it as being groundbreaking or doing something different with the medium?
Well, we certainly did something different, and we set out to do something different. I mean, I don't want to admit to necessarily call it groundbreaking, you know, maybe for Second City, but even, I don't know, it's a very different style that they had never done that before. Some people were not into it. Some people didn't want to do it and weren't crazy about it. It was a really good show. I was very, very proud of that show. You know, I think it was just a group of people, including the director. It really all started with Tom Giannis. You know, he really wanted to do something different and wanted to assemble a cast that was on board with that. And it was a really cool thing to get to do. I was just so excited to get to be doing a main stage show and then to get to do that style of show with that group of people to cast. I mean, it was a great experience, and I don't think they've stuck with it. I think they've kind of – I haven't seen a show there in a long time, unfortunately, but I feel like they've done some of the more traditional review-style shows and cabaret style. But, you know, it's not like we didn't like that old style. I think we just wanted to do something different, and – I'm glad we did, for good or bad. I know we got a lot of critical praise and all that, but I just, you know, for me, it was more, we did a really good show, and I'm proud of it.
Comedian John Glazer, his show, John Glazer Loves Gear, is up on True TV right now. Also, you know, born in Detroit, but came to Chicago at some point and starred Second City for the show Pinata Full of Bees over 20 years ago, 1995. John, thanks so much for taking some time out. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Of course. Thanks for having me, and also always good to talk Chicago.
That's right. It's just a character flaw. I got a character flaw. It's been too long. We haven't heard that in a long time here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Character Flaws, where we bring you sketch comedy, improv, and characters from this great city of Chicago, the mecca of comedy. Tonight, we will hear from some great improvisers, Susan Messing, Rachel Mason, Robin Scott, Sandy Marshall. So excited to have them back on the program. We got a little home improvement. We've got some tech solution, I guess. See? And some new characters, and of course, some old. All right, as we continue here tonight on the download, 720 WGN. Man, I'm thirsty, I'll tell you. You know, every time I get thirsty, Pete, I get
sad because I think of our former interns, Brittany and Brittany. For those who don't know, we had two great interns. I wouldn't say great, but interns, Brittany and Brittany. And they just kind of disappeared. We haven't seen them in, I don't know, months. We actually filed a missing persons report. And we just assume, I guess, they just went back to school. They were sophomores, I think perennial sophomores at ASU. So every time I get thirsty, I think about them because they used to bring water or not bring water. And that was kind of the joke. It's sad. Wait a second. Look outside that window. Hey, it's Brittany. Brittany. Come in here.
Which Brittany do you want? I'm Brittany, and she's Brittany.
I'm still Brittany.
I know who you are. Hi. Where were you guys? We've been worried sick. We've been gone for like 3 months.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Cubs won the World Series.
Oh, my gosh. The Cubs won the World Series. We're so happy.
Oh, my God. This was the best party I've ever been to in my whole life.
We don't remember it, so we haven't been here.
All I know is, at the turn of the century, was the last time the Cubs won a World Series, and this was a party worthy of that.
Was it the turn of the century? That's
108 years ago is practically the turn of the century.
Oh, practically, yes, in terms of practicality.
But, so wait, you guys have been off the grid, can't answer your texts, your phone, you don't show up to work, you don't do anything. I mean, I checked with, like, your family, everything.
I was almost
for the Cubs?
Mrs. Zen Bobrist, okay?
I was going to be a bridesmaid, and I was like, you have to let me wear a nice dress.
We fell in love on a trolley, hard. And that's where the story begins and mostly ends, because I don't remember a lot of it.
I was supposed to remember it, and then I forgot because I was blackout drunk.
Chris Bryant picked you up off the floor several times.
Did he? Did he hold me like a baby?
Like a baseball baby.
I know we sent you up there to cover the Cubs, especially when the playoffs began. That's the last time we saw you. I had no
idea. It was the greatest assignment of our lives, and I can't thank you enough, Jason.
This just was...
I remember it being tied, and then I remember overtime, and then I remember tequila.
Well, see, here's the thing. You know, when you don't get paid for overtime, mm-hmm. that's upsetting, and a lot of people aren't being paid for overtime. So promptly, that's probably when I forgot, because we never get paid for our internship.
Well, you don't get paid for the regular internship or overtime because it's unpaid.
You will never need to pay me again. This was the greatest celebration of baseball and humanity in the history of humanity and baseball.
Right.
The good news is that we have pictures.
And uh-huh. feelings.
Well, we're going to need to see those pictures because it was a month ago.
Well, the weird thing is I was required to take the pictures, so unfortunately my game wasn't very good because of tequila. So I found, like, I took a picture of, I think, your shoulder, mm-hmm. and then there was a Cubs uniform next to her.
Look, this one's a picture of a clock. This one is a picture okay. of me standing in front of a clock.
Okay. Yes, it was such a pretty clock. It had, like, filigree.
This one is a picture of us crying.
We don't need to scroll through all of your pictures, although the police may want to because you have
oh,
been...
Oh, look, this is a picture of the police. I can't tell you how meaningful it was to be in a place where baseball and friends were friends with all of each other.
Yeah, it was really exciting to be near baseball, on baseball, as far as Brittany's concerned, under baseball, you know what I mean?
Walking home from Cleveland gave us a lot of time to think. And then the parade, I haven't felt that way since Lollapalooza. It was so many friends all loving baseball.
Here's the thing about Cleveland. I think it was like planes, trains, and automobiles. I think we walked, mm-hmm. and then I think we took something that moved and something else that moved.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember who moved us.
We got to Wrigleyville in time to get to the trolleys. That was the most important thing.
Oh, my God. We were on a trolley with some sort of newscaster. It was just us. So we, like, jumped off of one, like we were Superman, into another one and found all the men.
We work for the news, too.
So we felt like we had credentials.
Right. Well, those credentials, those were hard to come by. And there were some actual reporters that didn't get credentials. So I don't know how you got so lucky.
Jethro, if you were lucky, you would understand.
Well, it's Justin. So it's great to see you guys. I'm not sure what happened here and why it's been a month.
It was the greatest assignment of our lives.
I think the moral of the story here is I need to stop sending you.
Go Cubs, go.
Nobody wants to hear that right now.
It's Chicago, what do you say? Cubs are going to
World Series.
Brittany and Brittany.
Good one.
Good to have you back. We're going to take a quick break so we can have a serious meeting.
Go Cubs, go. Hey, Chicago, what do you say?
You like that laugh? Come back in. Susan Messing, Rachel Mason, two great improvisers here in town, both in the group The Boys, which you can see on stage. Look it up online, The Boys. Susan and Rachel playing Brittany and Brittany among other characters here on Character Flaws. All right, so we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we will learn more about Joshco and also get some home improvement tips. Stay with us. It's Character Flaws here on The Download. Man, there's something wrong with the toilet again, Pete. The WGN downstairs toilet here. I don't know. It's just that bathroom has just always got problems. And, you know, you try to call the Tribune building maintenance staff, and it takes a couple. You got to put an order in. So here in The Download, we've decided just to come up with our own person to do it, right? The Download's fixer-upper. Let's bring him in. Rick Wolf. Rick, The Download's fixer-upper. Good to see you. Come on in. Come on in. Sit down.
Yeah, what's up? How are you doing, Justin?
Good. I just wanted to say that thank you for doing this. We appreciate it.
Sure.
The bathroom is having some problems with the toilet. It just seems to be running like nonstop.
Have you tried to catch it? Sorry. That's a joke I do every time when someone says that, because everyone says it's running, but it's not, because it's the water inside.
No, I get that.
So what's going on with your commode?
Well, it's not just mine. It's the whole town. It just seems like it just doesn't work.
All right. Well, I'm going to get in there. I'm going to have a look at it. I have not always had great success with commodes because you can get real slippery around there, because the water leaking out of the base of the commode.
Yeah.
Caused me to do like a Scooby-Doo thing with my feet, and I nearly drowned in a commode, but I'm willing.
Well, that's not the issue here.
Willing to go back in there. That's why I'm trying to talk about my bravery.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I get it. I didn't recognize that you had PTSD off of fixing toilets.
Well, there it is.
Yeah, but maybe we'll start. There's other things too that need to be fixed in the studio. We got the headphone jack. That seems to be a problem. We've got a little bit of the ceiling issues. You know,
I'm glad you said it, because I was thinking, what is going on here?
Right, but I think we just go one at a time. I don't really want to get into the electrical stuff, because that's, you know, that we got guys for
that. Oh, no. Well, yeah, you sure do. You got me.
Well, Rick.
And Rick Wolf, like, I'm a pack. Okay, so you need several guys. Call this one, because I'll tell you what, if it ain't broke, break it, because I need a job.
Right.
How's that?
It sounds
good.
So
let's get in here. What are we going to start with?
Well, I mean, like I said, someone will do the headphone jack.
No, I got that, because I got some screwdrivers on me.
No, that's probably not a smart.
No, I got some screwdrivers. Or I'm going to stick some keys in an outlet just to make sure that the electricity is on in here.
I wouldn't do that. There's a lot of amps that come into the studio.
That's absolutely no problem, so I'm going to get in here. Here we go. All right.
Rick.
I don't know if I'm going to use my pointy or my flatty. I'm going to take the flatty. I'm talking about screwdrivers, Justin. It's some tool talk.
No, I hear you, yeah.
All right. And one moment, we're just going to start clanging around in here. Going to clang. Okay. All right. I'm going to... God, please don't say
that! Rick!
Oh,
Rick!
Oh,
Pete, Rick's on the floor. Rick, are you okay? Are you all right, Rick?
I am. You know what? I have always had cataracts in both my eyes. I don't have it anymore.
Wow.
You're okay. I think my electrocution, I get electrocuted a lot, which is why my hair looks like this. It's real bristly, like buffalo hair.
I wasn't going to say anything, but it does look
No,
nice.
You can't compliment it, because I think that's a powerful animal. Yeah. I don't have my cataracts no more.
Wow, well, awesome. I don't think that's the way to do it. You're not going to just shove a screwdriver into an electric
Well, I think I just did, and hello, can you hear me? Because I think it's working.
The headphones are... still either shorted out or crossed, but that's okay. You know what? Let's not touch that stuff.
Oh, we already did. So you're welcome for that.
No, you know, maybe we just, if you could just, instead of fixing it, maybe just consult on it. Like, just tell us what's wrong with it.
Oh, okay.
So like the ceiling, for instance, I mean, that just
that
seems
is above
like
our heads.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it could be, I don't know what's wrong with it, but it does seem a little bit multicolored.
Well, it's multicolored because it probably has some kind of a mold on it. I'm detecting some kind of a blue algae usually found in the ocean.
Yeah, Rick, don't climb. Don't get up on. No,
no,
please don't
I'm going to get up here. That's fine, because I'm a smaller man, smaller stature, got tiny feet like a little. Okay, here I am.
Be careful.
I'm looking at
this,
and I tell you what, as long as I'm going to get a big pool of. Oh! Oh, no, my hair! Hold on, messed up.
Rick,
I'll tell you what I had found in there were you had a family of raccoons
in the Tribune Tower studio.
Yeah, and one just socked me in the face.
That's why you fell off the not because of the untied
shoes.
Oh
no, no, because as you can see, right. I wear these shoes that look like gloves. So
right,
I can use my.
They just seem real slippery.
Well, I got a grip. It was a raccoon.
Okay, it's doubtful.
Punched my face.
It's.
Justin, do you not believe?
No,
are you going to challenge me?
I just don't think there's a family of raccoons in the Tribune Tower ceiling that punched you in the face to get you to fall down. I'm not challenging. I'm just.
Well,
just,
you are. You're just saying you don't believe me because why else would I have fallen if a raccoon?
Because
he looked right at me. I swear.
Because you wear work gloves as shoes. It's just something I could tell when you were getting up there. It seemed a little slippery. So I'm just saying that might not be raccoons. It may be more like a
small person dressed as a raccoon. That is honestly what I thought. And I'll tell you now that we're getting real here, it was a small man. He was dressed as a raccoon. And I said, I'm going to dump you down there. And he said, no, you're not.
So you had a conversation up there that.
Why'd you think I was getting so quiet up there?
Well, you weren't. I mean, we could play back the tape. You weren't. It was.
Play back the tape.
We're not going to
play back the tape.
No, that's not
going
to.
And I said, I'm going to tell him you're up here. And he goes, no, you're not. And then he said a curse word. And I said, I don't do that. And then I roared back because I was going to take him down. Mm-hmm. And you know what he did? Punched me right in my mouth. And that's why I fell down. Mm. So what else are we going to fix?
I think, I mean, it's just, that's pretty much it, right, Pete? I think that this was.
You had mentioned something about a commode.
No, I mean the toilet, but I think the toilet, we'll just save that for the Tribune Tower maintenance people.
Oh, I'll come back, and so it'll be a second charge.
Yeah, I think we're good right here. I think.
I'll come. I'm living in my hatchback right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, that hatchback that's double parked on Michigan Avenue.
That's the one.
Towed away right now. Not a great place to park it.
Well,
right
I've
then.
Met a family of small people dressed as raccoons.
Right,
they might want to take me in.
Yeah, it sounds like you're networking. That's good.
And so for that, Justin, along with the toed you have given me, I will say thank you,
Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Wolf.
That's right.
Downloads Fixer Upper. Thanks for coming in and auditioning. We appreciate it.
Oh, wait a hold on. I thought this was a gig.
Well, it was. You know, we just want to do a tryout. We do that on the radio. We try out.
And I nailed it. You're welcome. Like with a hammer.
Yeah.
So what I just did is I made a play on words.
You did. Yeah. It's just there's a lot of damage already to the studio from when you electrocuted yourself and fell and broke the two microphones. And I think we'll just.
I did report a family of small people dressed as raccoons.
You did, and we're thankful for
that. I should get
that.
Something for that. Right. I'm like $10.
All right, I'll give you $10.
Thanks. Success.
Thanks, Rick. Rick, of course, played by Robin Scott. Robin Scott is a great improviser here in Chicago. You could see her at so many different places, whether it be at The Annoyance or Second City or Improv Olympic. But we definitely have to have Rick, the fixer-upper. Back in studio. It's just a character flaw. I got a character flaw. You never please a mom. It's just a character flaw. Welcome back to Character Flaws here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know, after a whirlwind few weeks of nonstop political coverage, we wanted to take some time to catch up on the latest trends in the world of technology. I know you've been wondering whatever happened to those cordless Apple earbuds or those exploding Samsung phones. Well, with the recent reports of incoming rifts between a Trump White House and Silicon Valley, there's another company on the scene looking to create a new kind of conversation through a new kind of app. I'll be honest, I read about this on their website, and I'm not sure what they actually do. But their CEO is here to explain it all. He's actually standing by at the airport. He goes to LAX to SFO and LAX to SFO back and forth. He's Josh McGee, and his company is called Josh Co. Josh, welcome to the download. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about Josh Co. and what you do.
So Josh Co. is a data solutions company that focuses on both data and solutions, but we're sort of like a platform. So, like, I guess if you, like, imagine all the people in the world and put them on, like, one big silver serving platter so they can connect with each other, that's Josh Co.
So kind of like Facebook.
Sort of, but we do things differently. We actually love Facebook. In fact, I was just on the phone with Mark Zuckerberg, who you might know, and we were talking about some funny API stuff the other day, just having a fun little conversation.
What's API for everyone out there? What is API?
So, you know how a farm has animals?
Sure.
An API is kind of like that, but with the feed bin. You know, it keeps the animals fed.
So Joshco's a new social media thing.
Sorta. Lots of people ask me, Josh, what's Joshco about? What's the secret? So for us, you're the secret.
I don't get it.
So everyone processes data, right? We all just do it a little bit differently. So it's sort of like people first and then revenue later.
Hold on. You say people first, but how many people actually work for Joshco?
So like we have like 431 amazing employees, including programmer, who is my little miniature pug. And we're based in Silicon Valley with a valuation at over $4 billion. And we have a ways to go, but we have fun while we do it.
It's great, Josh. This sounds great. But I'm not sure what you do or what you sell. But what are some of the challenges with Joshco?
Yeah. So that's a fun question. Joshco doesn't really have any operating revenue. So
you mean money?
Kind of
what do you mean? You mean money?
Cash. Exactly. So funny you should ask. You know, I was wondering, and this is sort of out there, not to put the cart before the horse or get too far ahead of ourselves, but, you know, if you have, like, the number of the main guy, Eddie Z's, like, I heard their ads on your show, and I was wondering if they wanted to become an early-stage investor in something kind of meaningful and kind of game-changing, really. You know, when I started Joshco, it was just me, a story, a pad of paper, and people who are ready to make things easier. And that idea was pretty quick to take off.
You know what? I don't think I can give you the number of the head of Eddie Z's who sell blinds.
Okay. That's good. So that's sort of a yes. So super side question. Are you hiring? Could I be available to, like, come in and, like, you know, do the knobs or, you know, pot the levels up and down or, like, whatever's easy? Right. You know, you let me know.
Not Josh McGee, the CEO of Joshco, who is the newest thing in Silicon Valley, and we still don't know what they do. Josh, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Justin, then think about the offer I made. Think about that. Could be good for you.
Yeah, sounds terrible. All right. I think I may invest. I'm definitely going to invest in Joshco. There's no doubt about it once I figure out what they do. Josh McGee, the CEO of Joshco, played by Sandy Marshall, improviser guy, and Sean Freddy. Hear him on the download all the time. All right, that was Character Flaws tonight. We got it in. Coming up after the news, we're going to talk with a couple friends of mine who are back in town, Eileen Hyken and Weiss, who is a former producer reporter in town, who actually just gave it all up to go tour the world. So we're going to talk with her coming up here after the 10:30 news. But first, let's get a break, and then we'll get to Rob in the news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we're off tomorrow night because of the Blackhawks, but we'll be back on Friday night. We'll do a week in review. We'll talk to Jonah Newman from Chicago Reporter. We will also have comedian Amy Miller on the program. She's blowing up right now. And also musician Harmar Superstar will be on as well. So it's a good show on Friday night as well as tonight. And we will be off tomorrow. Does that make sense, Pete? Did that make sense? I think it made sense. All right, so in studio with me now, I'm very excited. This is so exciting. It's like a homecoming. My old buddy, Eileen Hyken and Weiss, who
Justin.
Is a producer and reporter at a different shop, and she has such a great story. And today I got a phone call from her that was like, okay, I said, where are you? Because I know that you have been traveling the world mm-hmm. since we last saw each other. And I said, where are you? In Peru? Are you where? Brazil? Where are you at? You said, no, I'm on Western Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? And I was like, I've been following your Facebook, and you've been everywhere around the world, and I invited you to come in. You also brought Kendall Klein with you. Kendall, your old roommate, who's also in town. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
So, Eileen, let's talk about this. When I knew we worked together at a media shop, and you quit to go essentially tour the world.
Yes, I took a job as a cycling and hiking vacations guide, and that's what I do now. Yeah, no media, no Chicago, just, you know, straight vacations.
So is there do you have a place? I mean, what do you do?
No, I kind of live out of my car by choice. It's not a sad thing, it's a happy thing. And I go wherever they assign me 60 days in advance.
And what are we talking about? These are tours. These are essentially like tours that people say, I want to go to Peru. And you're the person. You specialize.
Active travel. So everything active. We're going to be moving. Yeah. Hiking, biking. And then, yeah, hiking and biking in pretty spots.
I also learned that hiking is really just walking.
I let Kendall in on that secret earlier. Because sometimes people ask me, what's the difference between hiking and walking? And the secret is that walking is fancy hiking.
Yeah, I was going to say that the secret is better shoes.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, pretty much more support.
More support.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are you liking it? I mean, you're liking your life of no structure, no cubicle, no sort of living in Chicago and doing things, and now you're just sort of living life from country to country?
Yeah, well, Kendall and I were just talking about this earlier today, because I think something that we both struggle with is bringing
a bit of freshness into life.
Yes.
Like how to keep life stimulating and interesting and unexpected in ways.
And Kendall has figured that out more than I have. I've decided just to change life so that life keeps surprising me, because then you don't have to figure out that riddle as much, and how to be fascinated with life. But ideally, both are key. And I feel like having the time to slow down a little bit and not listen to you in meetings has given me more of a chance to do that.
I feel like it's partially my I wouldn't say fault, but I gave you, because of the way that we work together, you're like, I'm done with this dude, so I am going to go tour the world. And it's so I feel like I'm half responsible.
You could
for
also
your success.
Say, Justin, you pushed her to go choose a life where she's living out of her car.
That's true. I could do that. Kendall, you have changed your life. You were in marine biology.
I worked at the Lincoln Park Zoo and the Shedd Aquarium, in different positions, some kind of animal care and training, and also some behavioral research. And now I live and work in Hollywood, USA, writing feature films.
Wow. So what was it about that transition? I mean, that's a big transition to say I'm going to get out of working at the zoo and I'm going to go to a different zoo.
Well, for sure. So the Lincoln Park Zoo is free, which is incredible. So it's an incredible resource here in the city. And what I saw every day I worked there was, we get busloads and busloads of kids coming in since it's a free resource, and they'd run in the morning banging on the glass. Oh, look at the monkey, you know, gross. And if you took a time, like a minute, and just talked to them, you saw this like connection of empathy form really quickly. And suddenly they realized, oh, it's not a monkey, it's an ape, and I'm an ape too. And it lives in a family just like I do, and its habitat's threatened. Now I want to be a scientist so I can save it. And I witnessed every day working, especially at Lincoln Park, just because it's such a resource for the community, the power of like narrative. And I think that started to push me a lot more towards story.
Oh, yeah.
Because with story, you can really bridge empathy and give knowledge kind of a narrative behind it that helps people connect.
Eileen, in your line of work, being a reporter and a producer, how has that helped you in making that transition to sort of live off the land and go to the climb the highest mountains and essentially be an active tour guide?
Oh, that is a good question. I mean, basically what people want is to feel like they can share their story rather than kind of live a new one sometimes. A lot of it is just sharing. So I find myself listening and asking a lot of questions that sometimes may be more interesting to listen to the answers to or not. It all comes down to people in life. And people just want to share what they've experienced, learn about others. And so those skills have been surprisingly transferable.
I read somewhere, and I've always wanted to ask you about this, because this was an active travel piece about that this is becoming sort of the go-to thing that people late in their lives, and was it the New York Times?
Yeah.
In their 70s are like, yo, I really want to go to Peru. I want to go to South. I want to go somewhere before I can't anymore. And in that article, they talked about how that also presents a lot of challenges for the tour guide, because you get a lot of people who are not ready to climb a mountain, who you have to pay attention because they're not used to this kind of strenuous activity. I mean, is that truth?
Yeah.
I mean, is that article very similar to your experience?
If you're in your 60s, I would suggest going to Machu Picchu now. There's a certain number of legal constraints where travel companies aren't allowed to ask you about your physical condition, which puts people like me in an interesting position, because you really want to help people stretch their boundaries, but you do find yourself sometimes helicoptering people out of Yellowstone.
Really?
Or having, yeah, the thing that people don't realize is at Yellowstone, you're at like 8,000 feet altitude. In Cusco, you're anywhere between 8,000 and 11,000. And altitude triggers all kinds of pre-existing conditions. So people will come thinking they're on vacation, then all of a sudden, heart attack. Yeah. Oh, no. So, but you can't ask about that. So, right. Yeah. No, I guess journalism's prepared me to just take what comes.
Yeah.
And
I
to
guess
trust
so.
That
I guess,
gut.
Trust that gut.
Sometime. Never mind.
Kendall, for you, I mean, you know, it's amazing to think about the connection from what you did at the zoo to how you work in Hollywood or tell stories. You know, one of the things about Hollywood is, I mean, it's a difficult place to sort of land or to get a footing. I mean, how do you go about making sure that, you know, you have project to project, that you're successful in Hollywood?
I think the thing I remember, so I went to grad school at the American Film Institute, and we had everyone under the sun, you know, directors, writers, actors coming in and talking to us, and every single person had a different story. And they'd say the talent is, you have to have the talent, you have to have the determination, but you also have to have a lucky break. And no matter who you are, you can't make it without a lucky break. So I think that's like the magic ingredient. But you have to love it, and it's a hard thing sometimes to keep that love alive with it, because it is such a brutal town, and it's as hard to break into as everybody says it is. But if there's a purity in process, which I think is in any creative discipline, you have to have that. If there's a purity in the process, I think that for me, at least, that's what sustains me. Like, I write a lot of biopics, so true stories rooted on these historical figures, most of whom passed away before I was even born. But I fall so in love with those individuals, especially I'm really drawn to like kind of the forgotten misfits of life, you know, like the Tiny Tims and the Vampiras and those individuals whose stories, you know, just not quite known. And I think that gives me a lot of drive, is to sort of do justice to those lives that got kind of swept under the rug.
Kendall Klein and Eile Heikkinen-Weiss in studio with me tonight, former roommates here in Chicago who gave up, both had, you know, both worked at big institutions here
for
in Chicago and moved on. Just one day walked in and said, you know what, I'm going to the mountains of Peru. You know what? One day, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to Hollywood. We're talking to him about those life changes and how easy it is to make life changes if you need to. Eile and Kendall in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 and WGN Radio in studio. Wrap up tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up at 11. Eile Heikkinen-Weiss and Kendall Klein, former Chicagoans who both got sick of it all at the tender age of, what, 25?
30. Like,
30.
Younger for this one. 22 for that one.
And just said, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm changing my life. But it's kind of interesting, because I think about a lot of people who might be listening who are in careers or places they want to be, and they want to make a change. And that's kind of become the thread of tonight's show, this idea of like what it takes to sort of jump off and do it. And you both have done that. You've changed direction in your life. You know, what are some of the I guess I'll ask you, Eile, because every time I say, man, it's so cool that you to climb up a mountain, you're like, my life is nothing. I don't really do anything. I mean, do you really think that? I mean, you have sunk into this idea of living off the land and essentially being an active tour guide for people in the most remote places of this world.
Okay, so I live a really great life, and that doesn't escape me. And my job is to take people to the most beautiful places on the earth, and that doesn't escape me. But the thing that people don't realize is, like, I'm not talking to you on an everyday basis, yeah, every true. Month basis. I'm not posting the times when I'm, like, crying alone in a room on Facebook.
No, like, that's all of us.
Exactly, and I'm just one of you all, like, yeah, I think that everyone feels a little insecure in themselves, no matter what you what your age is and what you're doing. And I would say overall, I feel a lot more fulfilled and alive, because there was this nagging feeling that I was letting my life kind of escape me, even though it was really awesome because I had you as a boss and I was doing journalism. So in that way, yeah, I'm a lot happier. But life is still what you make it every single day. I just feel like I have less of those stressors nagging at me, where I can actually engage in one-on-one conversations and kind of lap up the weirdness that comes to me.
I will say, I don't know if you have this problem, Kendall, in Hollywood, but the last time that I talked to you, you were recovering from getting bit by a dog on a street in some random South American town. Where were you?
I was in Cusco, and I was hospitalized for a week for having an infected leg. you know, which is kind
because
of important.
Because some random dog just came up and
yeah.
bit you in the
okay.
leg?
Okay, so all my friends, was it Star Wars that was just released or Star Trek okay. last summer? Right. Yeah, that's, right. he had, yeah. So anyways, all my friends went to go see that and wanted me to come. And I was like, I haven't exercised in a while now. And I went speed walking and a dog was threatened by my pace. And he came up and he bit me.
I was going to say, it's a similar style in Hollywood, but it's usually it's maybe not dogs biting your legs. It's just,
oh, you get the rabies.
It's producers. But I mean, yeah, those are sort of the strange pitfalls of the job.
Oh, yeah.
There's
I mean,
a weird
was...
way that you have wild, rabid sort of dogs that are biting your legs.
But on that note, did you see my pictures from the hospital? Because I did have a really good time in the hospital. It was sad. I cried a lot, but I also laughed a lot. I mean, like, people are amazing wherever you go, and you just have to kind of be on the radar for it a little bit more. And I was not in that frame of head. I think in cities, it's kind of hard to do that, although Chicago is a very good city at seeing the best in people.
All right, let me ask you one last question, both of you. Kendall, for you, here we are. We're at the end of the year. You guys are, you know, I mean, I think, Isla, you ship back out in a couple weeks here,
yeah,
right?
I get deployed again.
2017. What do you guys think? What is the sort of goal for you? I mean, you're a writer in Hollywood. I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, do you sort of look at it year by year and say, okay, you know what? I'm going to make the best of this decision that I've made to change my life, and I'm going to kick this year in its ass.
Yeah, I think 2016 was for me personally, was a rough year. So with 2017, I think my goal for this next year is, you know, I feel like Hollywood's doing a great job right now of pushing a lot of narratives that sort of are a lot more united, if you know what I mean. But I feel like there's also still a huge disconnect, and that's something that I've really come to realize in the last few weeks especially. And so I would really like to be looking towards stories that can really, really find some common thread in a deeper way than I think I've ever felt the call to do before. So for me, like, projects in Hollywood, they take so long to get off the ground, and there's so many starts and stops. So it's more looking at, I think, the attitude by which you're approaching your work is something that I would really like to develop and hone in on a little bit and keep a real positivity with, because that can be hard sometimes.
Eiley.
Mine's a lot more superficial.
Not get bit by a dog.
I was just thinking about this yesterday. In 2017, I would like to eat better. I ate 4 pastries at Chris Kindle Market 2 days ago. And
she ate 6.
I got a 3-for-1 deal. And last night we went to Walgreens and got hot Cheetos, pretzels.
Chocolate-covered pretzels.
And it's just like...
Is it just because you're back in the States and you're like,
I've always had a binger in me in like a fun way. Like, yeah, I just really enjoy eating. But I would like to be able to eat when I'm older, like 70. So if I want to get to that age, I got to stop with the hot Cheetos and Takis.
No more hot Cheetos and Takis. Eiley Hyken and Weiss, Kendall Klein in studio, former Chicagoans who are back in town and have changed a course in their lives. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it, guys.
Thanks.
Thank
you.
It's great to see you. Jane Manzuris is in for Patty Vasquez tonight. She's up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN and WGNRadio.com. Always good to hear from Jane.